Well, good morning, and welcome to the first meeting of the PCAOB's Investor Advisory Group. I want to thank all of you for participating and agreeing to donate your time, expertise, and commitment to this advisory group. I particularly welcome SEC Commissioner Elise Walter. Commissioner Walter, your long-standing commitment to the protection of investors is well known, and your presence here means a great deal to us, as does your interest in the PCAOB. And Elise was telling me that her dad was an accountant and a CFO. So we welcome that background, your heredity, and at one point you indicated that you might want to have been an accountant, but you went into a different direction, and I think it was Harvard Law School and the lawyer. But in any event, we're delighted to have you and your interest. This group was formed to provide a public forum specifically for the board to obtain the views of and advice from the broad investor community on auditor oversight matters affecting investors. Too often, in my opinion, regulators hear, for the most part, from those they regulate and not enough from their other key stakeholders. Today, we are reaching out specifically to representatives of the investor community. As such, we seek your direct input and want to hear your views and specific recommendations for the priorities of the PCAOB. Our mandate, as spelled out in the very first sentence of Title I of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, is to, quote, to oversee the audit of public companies that are subject to the securities laws and related matters in order to protect the interest of investors and further the public interest in the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports, close quote. In assigning the board this mandate, Congress recognized that high-quality independent auditors are vital for maintaining the transparency and investor trust in reported financial information that enables our markets to function effectively. We look forward to your input on ways to improve our programs and how best to accomplish our mandate to protect and serve the interests of investors. All of the board members and senior staff of the PCAOB are here today because we recognize how much we can benefit from your expertise and experience. Turning to the format for today's meeting, as you know, we solicited input from all of you as to your top four or five priorities for the PCAOB to consider, and you provided us with lists of important and far-ranging topics. We have taken your recommendations and structured them into broad categories, and I particularly want to thank Joanne Heineman for her efforts in both the substantive and administrative organization of this meeting and the spreadsheet that you have in front of you. Each of you should have received a spreadsheet summarizing the recommendations and should have a copy in front of you together with a folder including a variety of information for about today's meeting. We have tried to structure our meeting around these broad topics with the objective of providing every member with an opportunity to discuss his or her top priority. More specifically, the topics will be presented today as part of five panel discussions as follows. First, we will have a discussion on lessons learned from the financial crisis and the establishment of a fraud center. Initiating discussion will be Brandon Becker and Mike Head. Next, we will discuss foreign inspections with Joe Crisella and Ann Yerger leading those discussions. After lunch, we will talk about greater transparency and governance of audit firms with Pete Noctway, Ann Simpson, and Lynn Turner during the introductions. And Lynn, I want to thank you personally for being here. I know that you were invited to testify this morning, you know, on the Hill in front of Senator Specter at the Judiciary Committee. So we appreciate your presence. I know that Barbara Roper and Damon Silvers did accept that invitation, and they will be here later. Then we will focus on greater transparency of the audit process with Kelvin Blake, Norman Harrison, and Bonnie Hill. And the last panel discussion will be on auditor expertise and responsibilities with Tony Sondi, Judge Stanley Sporkin, and Bob Tirola. After a very brief introduction of the panel by one of the PCOB board members, each panel will initiate and discuss their topic and then lead the other group members in a discussion of the topic. At the end of the day, there will be a sixth session reserved for an open discussion on any topics not adequately addressed by the panel discussions. In short, we have structured this meeting in order to provide an opportunity for an open discussion by the group so that we can hear your views and priorities for the PCAOB. Throughout today's meeting, I would ask that each of you keep in mind and seek to answer the question, how do we make audits more relevant to investors? I would also note that today's meeting is being webcast. Since we would like the open discussions to be informal and free-flowing, please do not feel as though you have to be recognized to speak. We would ask, however, that for the benefit of those listening to the webcast, you identify yourself the first time you speak and periodically throughout the day. This meeting is open to the public, and the group members' written statements that we received have been posted on our website. Now, before getting started, let me recognize our acting chairman, Dan Geltzer, then SEC Commissioner Walter, and our board members, Bill Gratison and Charlie Niemeyer, and open up the floor to them for any opening remarks that they would like to make.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'd just like to join you in welcoming everyone to this inaugural meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board's Investor Advisory Group. As Steve has noted, the board's mission is investor protection. Our job is to further the interests of investors in reliable audited financial reporting. Despite that fact, understanding what investors want and need, I think, has proven to be somewhat of a challenge for us. We certainly hear frequently from individual auditors, from accounting firms, from preparers, and naturally so, because our work directly affects them. But I think we have less input from investors, and this group has been created in order to try and change that state of affairs. Under Steve's leadership, as he's already outlined, we've put together a very, I think, ambitious and wide-ranging agenda of topics today, and I'm certainly looking forward to hearing everyone's views on what we ought to be doing to address these issues that confront us. I'd just add that I think this advisory group's been created at an especially appropriate moment in the life of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. We've been in operation about 7 years now. It's hard for me to believe that 7 years have passed. In that time, much of what we've done has been devoted to taking the blueprint that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act laid out and making it into a functioning, active set of programs. And indeed, we do have an inspection program, standard-setting program, enforcement program, risk assessment effort, all of which, if not fully mature, are at least robust adolescents at this point. So I think it's a good time now for us maybe to step back a bit and ask ourselves what challenges have emerged along the way and what we ought to be doing better or differently in order to accomplish our mission. I certainly see this meeting today as part of that kind of assessment process. As Steve has noted, we're very fortunate to have one of the SEC commissioners here with us today, Elise Walter. This is particularly a treat for me because Elise and I go way back. We worked together on the staff of the SEC in the 70s and 80s. It's okay to say that, isn't it, Elise? I hope. Elise then went on to also serve at the CFTC and to work at FINRA, so I think she has a kind of a unique background for the sort of issues that we're going to discuss here today. She certainly has a well-known and long-standing reputation as an investor advocate. I'm glad that she's willing to devote her time to us here today. Elise, let me ask if you have any comments you'd like to make at the beginning.
Thank you, Dan, and I want to thank Steve as well for his very kind words. Whether it's because of heredity or because of my years with Dan or because of my years in the Division of Corporation Finance at the Commission, I think accounting is somewhat in my blood, and I do think that auditors are particularly important to the proper working of our investor protection and capital formation systems. They really are critical gatekeepers. And what the PCAOB does, and it was a long time in coming, but it's good to have it here, is so critical to the Commission's overall mission and being successful in carrying it out. We share with you the challenges of effectively receiving investor voices, and in large part through the efforts of some of the people in this room who I know well. I think we're getting better at it, but we're not all the way there. So I, too, want to congratulate Steve for spearheading, setting up this group, and I look forward to what I get to hear today and becoming more educated. I do find that perhaps the greatest concentration of my time as a commissioner has been in the accounting and auditing area, so I confess to already spending a lot of time with accountants, and I'd actually like to spend a bit more, so I stand ready to be educated this morning and to add any value that I can. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you, Dan. I want to add my word of thanks to Steve for taking the lead in recommending that this group be created and inducing so many of you who bring so much knowledge to the table to join us here today and in the future. My own background actually was working directly with investors as a general partner of a small New York Stock Exchange firm in my hometown of Cincinnati for years, and we were mostly dealing with individuals and small businesses, small pension funds and profit-sharing funds, charities and things of that kind. Of course, the world has changed enormously since that time. Investors are far more involved in working through institutions, and that's been a very dramatic change. Many of you, perhaps all of you, bring to bear experiences that go way beyond the things that I learned when I was out in the field years ago, and I look forward to learning from you in the course of not only this session, but others in the future.
Charlie?
Well, certainly this is a very important event for us. I think Dan put it well that we're at a pivotal point in the evolution of the PCAOB and where we fit into the system. We have, I believe, a good foundation. But it is time to really take a look at what we've done, to take a look at what we need to do to improve. And from where I sit, there's still a lot of room for improvement. So we're very interested in hearing what you have to say and what we can do to make these things reality. Thank you.
And now before we actually get started, if we could go around the room and everybody very briefly introduce themselves. Judge, I'm not sure you need an introduction, but why don't you start?
Robert Tirola, good morning.
Well, you can actually identify yourself a little bit more than that. I think the judge was headed up the Division of Enforcement, was at the CIA, and was at Weill Gotshal, so you can make it just a little bit broader than that. I know the time is pressed, but Bob,
I'll expand a little bit more if you care to. My current involvement from an investor perspective is I serve on the board of directors of 15 mutual funds sponsored by Legg Mason and an operating company listed on NASDAQ based in Denver. My experience is about a dozen years as a public company CFO, a dozen years as a public company auditor, currently serve on two audit committees.
Okay, how's that? Do I need to start all over, or am I okay? Bonnie Hill, and I think I've said enough.
I'm Tony Sonley. I run a financial consulting and advisory firm. I'm also a member of the Emerging Issues Task Force of the FASB, and I've been involved in standard setting as a financial analyst and as a user of financial statements for a little more than 9 years in a direct form. I've also written books on financial analysis and on various accounting issues that fortunately for me are widely used. Thank you.
Norman Harrison with Breeden Capital Partners. My firm is headed by Richard Breeden, a former chairman of the SEC. We invest in public companies with a view toward increasing value for shareholders by focusing on improvements in governance and the manner in which improved governance translates into improved strategy and operations and as a device to create value for shareholders. I'm a lawyer and investment banker by training, not an accountant, so I'm a bit humbled by the company in which I sit, but I'm very, very glad to be a part of the group.
My name is Kelvin Blake. I'm a lawyer for the Division of Securities for the State of Maryland, which is a part of the Attorney General's Office. I work in the Investment Advisor Broker-Dealer Unit.
I'm Gus Sauter. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Vanguard Mutual Funds. We have over 150 mutual funds investing more than $1 trillion in public companies, so we're very interested in gaining more information and being able to better analyze financial statements.
I'm Meredith Williams. I work for about 460,000 of the very best people in the state of Colorado, running the public pension plan called PERA. Thank you.
I'm Ann Simpson, and improbable though it sounds, I work for CalPERS. I'm the senior portfolio manager, and I'm responsible for the governance program there. However, I think Steve originally invited me to join this group because of my international background. Prior to that, I worked for the International Corporate Governance Network, which represents investors in some 40-odd countries. And before that, I headed the World Bank's governance programs in the wake of the Asia crisis. Some very familiar debates then about auditing and accounting. And before that, I was managing director of an investment firm in London for many years.
Pete Nakwe, I'm the CFO for Carlyle. That's my primary day job, although I've been chief cook and bottle washer with everything that goes on in our firm. Prior to joining Carlyle 3 years ago, I was a partner at Deloitte & Touche, where I was employed there for about 27 years, and the last job I had there was heading up the investment management practice in the Northeast.
Lynn Turner, I serve on the board of a mutual fund complex and also serve those 460,000 people in Colorado as the trustee of CoPERA.
I'm Ann Yerko with the Council of Institutional Investors. That's an association of public, corporate, and union employee benefit plans with about $3 trillion in assets. They have a very significant commitment to our U.S. markets, investing about 60% of their portfolios in just stocks and bonds of public companies here, and they obviously have a deep interest in the quality of the financial statements that are provided to them.
I'm Joe Carcello. I'm an accounting professor at the University of Tennessee and co-founder and director of research of our Corporate Governance Center. Done a lot of research on fraud, public company fraud, including a study that will be coming out by COSO shortly based on SEC enforcement actions, a lot of work on audit committees. I chair the audit committee of a governmental entity and had the privilege of serving on the PCAOB SAG for the previous 4 years.
My name is Michael Head, and I'm managing director of corporate audit for TD Ameritrade. About 30 years of combination public and private audit experience. Serve on the board of the Institute of Internal Auditors, the global body that oversees internal auditing around the world, and actually serve as the chair of their audit committee. Hope to bring some of the perspective of how internal and external audit work together, and in particular in the brokerage industry, and how we can advise and help the PCAOB strengthen some of how that audit approach can be considered going forward with some of their oversight.
Brandon Becker, Executive Vice President and Chief Legal Officer of TIA CREF, one of the largest private pension managers. We have 3.7 million participants. Prior to that, I was a partner in WilmerHale, responsible for its broker-dealer program. And prior to that, I was director of the Division of Market Regulation at the SEC.
Thank you very much. Before we get to our first discussion, I want to point out that in your folder, you should find a copy of the PCAOB's ethics policy. We ask that you please read the policy and provide us with a signed copy before you leave today. Now turning to our first topic, lessons learned from the financial crisis and the establishment of a fraud center. This topic was mentioned by a number of you as a top priority for the PCAOB to consider. Brandon Becker, you suggested that we should, quote, review the PCAOB and audit firm's performance leading up to the financial crisis. More specifically, you asked, how did audit firms measure risk, and did auditors have the necessary level of expertise? Mike Head, you brought it up in the context of broker-dealers. And those of you who have listed these issues as very high on your priority lists include Joe Carcello, Barbara Roper, Ann Simpson, Lynn Turner, Meredith Williams, and Ann Yerger. Some of you tied the concept of reviewing lessons learned from the financial crisis to the recommendations by the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the auditing profession that the PCAOB establish a fraud center. As you know, last month, we announced that we were seeking to fill a newly created position of director of the Financial Reporting Fraud Resource Center, which is being established in response to the Treasury Advisory Committee recommendation. So it is very timely that we hear your thoughts on these topics, particularly given the level of interest expressed by the IAG members, as well as recent events in the news. For example, just last week, the Financial Times reported that the European Commission is planning to scrutinize the role played by auditors, adding to a growing international focus on the profession in the aftermath of the financial crisis, which could lead to tighter supervision. Brandon, I would ask that you and Mike kick off the conversation on this first topic, and then we'll open up to all the members.
Thank you, Steve. At the risk of breaking your flow and taking a little editorial license, let me just add before turning to that topic how much all members of the Investor Advisory Group appreciate the board's willingness to make itself available to listen to our views, and in particular how much we appreciate the efforts that you made, Steve, as well as your staff, Joanne O'Rourke Hinman, to make this a successful advisory group and a seamless process. We very much appreciate your and the board's efforts and willingness to participate in this process, as well as those of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So our many thanks to you and the board. Turning to the topic of the panel, Steve has nicely recapitulated the overall arching theme. I think that I'll just try and put it in a little context before I turn it over to Mike to talk about some of the particular areas with respect to financial services. As the participants know, at least since Professor Andrew Lowe of MIT began his efforts to stimulate interest in a so-called Capital Market Safety Board, modeled after the CAB, there's been an active dialogue about whether there is some method short of enforcement where you could go back diagnostically and try and look at what's happened over the last couple of years with a view toward identifying problem areas and potential solutions or at least best practices on a going forward basis. One of the criticisms, or at least practical limitations on that, that has been highlighted by some commentators is that the issue is too broad. The problem was global. The markets involved were of such scope that the idea that one could actually go back and look at this particular event in the same way that, for example, the SEC special study looked at the 1962 market break, or comparable, more textured reviews, is just not within the realm of the doable, at least not within our lives and being. I think that is a little bit too stark of a definition of the issue, because if you look at the way in which various of our colleagues' papers talk about a fraud center, there can be a more targeted assessment. Steve has already mentioned, and the SEC has already begun its own assessment of how we were dealing with 105 transactions, so that you can, I think, if not aspire to a global encyclopedia of the crash, notwithstanding the fact that we seem to get a new book every week on the bubble and its consequences, one could envision looking at targeted practices and asking yourself whether, when we look back at those practices, there's something we can do going forward. Now, at its heart, I think that instinct
is to take a step beyond the it was an act of God, it was unforeseeable, received wisdom, said that no one could know how this was going to happen. Actually, as it has developed over time, there were voices, there were critics, there were people pointing out potential risks. They were just not in the majority view or the consensus view. So part of, I think, what we want to ask ourselves is why weren't those voices heard? What can we do to incorporate those voices going forward? And where can we identify failures in our practices? Some of the areas that at least have captured our attention and are described in more detail in my written testimony are how do we assess quality of earnings? How do we go back and look at unrealized gains and losses? How do we assess earnings based on models and estimates when we haven't been through the entire earnings cycle of a financial instrument? What can we do about tail risk going forward? It seems obvious that we're not going to eliminate the reliance upon modeling and trying to give estimates of quality of earnings, but at some point we should be able to get smarter in trying to deal with the kinkiness of tail risk and some of the problems in trying to rely upon that within any particular financial reporting period. And that's just another example. So whether it's repos or tail risk or other valuation issues, it strikes us that one could go back and try and look on a horizontal basis and assess whether we did the job correctly and how we can do it better. And in doing that, I think one of the instincts, the common sense instincts here, I would argue, is that if we can do that outside of the enforcement context is critical in terms of accountability, it's critical in terms of developing data and subpoena power and the like, but sometimes it doesn't give you the broad horizontal assessment of how you want an industry to be governed going forward. And to try and pull together a diverse set of resources to assess that, both economists and traders, lawyers and accountants, forensics and diagnostics, we think could provide valuable lessons for the industry as we confront what will undoubtedly be recurring issues as we come out of the current situation. So with that pitch, why don't you let me turn it over to Mike to talk about some of the particulars in the financial services industry.
Thank you, Brandon. And due to, you know, my background, I'll be fairly focused on broker-dealer and registered broker-dealers in that environment. And probably, you know, one of the obvious things to analyze and see if there's lessons learned can tie into situations like the Madoff. And the energy that myself, my company, and our industry probably were looking at that and trying to assess, were there some things that could have been done to either avoid that, minimize it, or identify it and address it in a more timely manner before some of the damages that took place did take place. As an internal audit professional, a long-term investor advocate, I'm very pleased that the PCAOB has made this very timely decision to focus on investor protection. I'm also pleased that the PCAOB is interested in considering ways it can target their efforts to increase investor confidence in the auditing financial information and auditors' reports and make that information and reports more useful to the individual investors. To that end, I offer some of the following thoughts on strategic direction and future emphasis that the PCAOB, through the Investor Advisory Group advocates efforts, could address in lessons learned. One of the primary things that I think we need to look at is not only the fraud center and analyzing and looking back, but are there some systemic opportunities here? As an auditor, we focus on processes. We focus on trying to get consistency in processes and then addressing exceptions or things that seem to be out of that norm. And to that end, I think there's three, four, or five things that the PCAOB should advocate and, where possible, require some consistent audit requirements for registered broker-dealers, both on the introducing broker-dealer side and the clearing and custodial broker-dealer side. Some of those could include in addition to requiring independent auditing firms of broker-dealers to register with the PCAOB, the audit firm should also be subject to inspection by the PCAOB. The retail advisor does not realize today that being registered with the PCAOB does not bring with it any true oversight by the PCAOB if it's not part of a publicly audited situation. Once the broker-dealer registered auditing firms are subject to inspection and oversight by the PCAOB, clearing broker-dealer organizations should be subject to the Sarbanes-Oxley Section 404 or similar requirements for compliance. There's been a lot of debate about has that achieved the objective that was intended, but I think if we're all really honest with ourselves, that it has brought the needed and appropriate attention to the internal controls over financial reporting and disclosure that was lacking prior to that, and that's still absent in the registered brokerage environment. It's gotten there through banking and through some others, but if you're a pure introducing or custodial broker-dealer and not publicly traded, you aren't subject to similar audit requirements nor management certifying their internal controls. And that discipline, I think, is a key element in improving the financial services broker-dealer environment. As a result, those auditing firms would be subject to auditing standard number 5. And I think that's critical, too, where, again, today, if you're not in a publicly traded broker-dealer situation, those auditing firms are not necessarily subject to auditing standard 5. Now, we would assume those firms, through their firm practices, would employ similar, but it's not required from oversight from a PCAOB point of view. These measures would enhance investor protection and the quality of the financial reporting available to and relied upon by the retail investor. And they don't understand. If you ask them, they would assume there's not any difference in an audited opinion they get on a non-public registered broker-dealer and a publicly traded registered broker-dealer. Once the broker-dealer registered auditing firms are subject to inspection and oversight by the PCAOB. Custodial broker-dealers in particular, I think, should be subject and required to have SAS 70 Type 2 service organization audits performed of their custodial controls. Currently, only affiliated custodial broker-dealers are required to comply with the SEC custody rule, the 2064-2, and are subject to this SAS 70 Type 2 audits under the recently revised SEC custody rules. Requiring a custodial control SAS 70 Type audit of all clearing broker-dealers, no matter if it's affiliated or not, would help enhance investor protection and the quality of the financial reporting. In both of the SOX 404 compliance and custodial controls related to a custodial or clearing broker-dealer, these are much more focused on not just internal controls over financial reporting, but all of the operating controls that support the processing of transactions and compliance with laws and regulations that ultimately the scorekeeping and the financial statements rely upon. But again, the retail investor assumes their assets are safe and they exist. And obviously, from what we saw with the Madoff situation, that may or may not be true, and we don't have the safety nets in place to allow for some oversight auditing and review by both internal auditors and external auditors to help ensure that with those retail investors that those assets exist, they're safeguarded, and the controls to protect them are in place. And I think the SOX 404 and the SAS 70 Type 2 are two just blocking and tackling table stakes that should be there for all registered broker-dealers. I also think we have an opportunity and was somewhat disappointed when AS5 came out to replace AS2, that in AS2 there was mention of the internal auditing global standards, and that went away in AS5. Now, just being recognized for the sake of being recognized is not what's important. What I think it emphasized there was the importance of consistency between companies and firms' internal audit functions, that they should be there and that there should be consistency so that people, regulators, shareholders, investors, and external auditors know when certain internal audit practices are in place. If they're adhering to standards, they have more reliance that it's consistent, that it's the same from one company to the next. And by acknowledging those standards and setting an expectation that when there's an internal audit function in place that is functioning at what's considered an adequate level, that they know what that means, that there's definitions in the standards that people can go to, retail investors and others, to tie to that. Finally, when we have internal audit functions that are comprehensive and can be relied upon, there is a lot of benefit for synergies and efficiencies, both for the regulators and external auditors, to review that work, place some reliance on it. But the standard that presently exists that kind of guides when and how you can do that, this current SAS 65, is quite dated, is over 20 years old, and does not and could not at that time consider the roles and responsibilities that internal auditors, professionals, currently take on. There's a unique timing and opportunity here with the IFAC and the convergence and consolidation and the gap in international standards, to not miss this opportunity that currently IFAC is currently revising ISA 610 use of work of internal auditors, and this is a perfect opportunity from PCAOB and from an auditing standards point of view to consider either revising or replacing SAS 65 and working with IFAC. The Institute of Internal Auditors is currently partnering with IFAC to revise 610 and would love the opportunity to work with the PCAOB to either revise or develop a new standard that would be similar and fit in with the goals going forward that are consistent global standards. Those are some of my initial thoughts. I know they're fairly tailored directly to broker dealers and not as broadly to the financial services industry, but I think there was a lot of the problems we encountered similar to the Madoff situation were some of these basic, once we looked at the hindsight situation, maybe couldn't have been totally prevented, but maybe could have mitigated or minimized some of the damage that was done if we would have had some of these things in place. And with that, I would open it up.
Well, Mike, thank you and Brandon very much. And I know that in terms of these two topics, a number of members put them very high on their priority list. And so in terms of lessons learned, I know that Ann Simpson and others have put that on a priority. But I know that on the Fraud Center, Ann Yerger, you had mentioned that as a very high priority. Maybe we'll start with you. But I know that Meredith Williams and Lynn Turner and Joe Carcello have also mentioned the Fraud Center as a very high priority, because that is an issue that the PCAOB is addressing. We welcome your comments on that, because I guess for lack of a better word, I view the Fraud Center as low-hanging fruit that maybe we can all agree upon in terms of what ought to be done. So I don't know, Ann Simpson, whether you want to start with the lessons learned, or Ann Yerger, you want to start with the Fraud Center. Dan?
Well, this is Ann Yerger, and I'm sort of right now representing also Damon Silvers, who called me yesterday sending his regrets. He couldn't be here and looks forward to joining us after he's on the Hill, and the sum total of what he told me to say fits on this note card. So I'm confident that his presentation would be far more expansive and articulate than what I'm going to share, but largely we're on the same page. And I think that Damon and my thoughts are that we were so supportive of the establishment of the PCAOB, and I think it was instrumental in helping restore public trust in the auditing profession and the quality of audited financials. But obviously fraud continues. Madoff is a perfect example, and there's no stopping ever fraud, I don't think, because there are always people who are going to try to break the laws or play fast and loose with the rules. But that there's an opportunity here to learn from problems, and as a result, we feel very strongly that the establishment of this National Fraud Center is absolutely critical. Damon and I and Lynn served on the Treasury Department's Advisory Commission on the Auditing Profession, and one of the core recommendations was that we believe the PCAOB should establish this fraud center. Just as background, there was a lot of debate about who should own this center. And the fact is that some folks wanted it to be housed with the profession, and I think that the majority of members, at least of the ACAP, believed very strongly that the appropriate place for this was with the PCAOB. You're an independent body, and we felt that the establishment of this entity could ultimately really assist the board in doing its work in terms of standard setting. Clearly, not only are there concerns about fraud, but I think the public, rightly so, has been concerned about the quality of, in some cases, it's been accounting standards, which I understand is not the purview of the PCAOB, but certainly auditing standards and professional conduct surrounding things varying from fair value accounting for financial statements or instruments, excuse me, off-balance sheet vehicles, repo 105s. And even loan loss reserves. And obviously right now we're centering a lot on financial entities because that has been where the most interest and I think concerns are centering. I think that the Fraud Center could play a really important role, not just addressing fraud, but addressing areas where there's the potential for fraud. So I think Damon and my message would be we encourage the board to make certain that the center is not simply a library for fraud, but it goes far beyond that. Damon recommended that the board consider applying some sort of safe harbor so that there's a comfort zone to share non-public information that may assist the board again in developing auditing standards and even in the FASB and ISB in terms of setting accounting standards. So with that, I'll stop. Happy to answer any questions, and Ann, I'll pass it to you.
Thank you. Ann Simpson, CalPERS. We didn't flag up the Fraud Center in particular as a priority because we felt that really the legacy of work or the unfinished business from ACAP is something that we hope the PCAOB will turn to. There's much there that's really important. We implored the group that worked on it, and we realise events have rather overtaken everyone, and it's time to return to that, and this is one piece of that work programme. I suppose our reflection is more that the banality of the run-up to the disaster is what troubles us, is the fact that everybody was seduced in the situation. And we know that boards of directors are reconsidering what went wrong. As investors, we're reconsidering what we weren't paying attention to. The credit rating agencies have been rightly the focus of attention for their role. But auditors have been relatively unexamined. And I'm struck, this is probably for me, speaking my age now, the third crisis discussion about what went wrong. Remember the days of Maxwell, Foreign and Colonial, a whole heap of British companies that collapsed following the issuing of clean audit reports. That gave rise to the now named Cadbury Code of Practice and sort of invented corporate governance for the UK anyway. Then we had the Asia crisis, the U.S. disasters around Enron and WorldCom, and now we are in the wake of the current disaster. So I suppose what we're puzzling on is how many things do we need to put right in order to really introduce safety and soundness into the system? And some of the things that are needed are quite ordinary, not extraordinary. We still are looking at some basic issues around transparency, as Anne said, about audit standards that do not capture relevant activity, that's very concerning, off-balance sheet activity being an obvious example. You know, concepts of internal controls that don't extend to all of the activities, that particularly in the financial sector, that were undertaken. Boards of directors who claim they did not understand what was going on. It's very troubling. If you had a dentist who didn't understand teeth, you'd pretty soon move on to another dentist. So, you know, this whole related discussion around majority voting, around proxy access, to hold boards accountable, I think that's very important. But also there are responsibilities for investors on what they're paying attention to as well, so we don't shirk our responsibility. So fraud is certainly the dramatic TV, CSI, end of this, but it's the ordinary, banal, routine activity of companies where we really want to tighten up the standards of old-fashioned transparency and accountability. So I really think this group's got an important job to do, to think in very practical terms. What is it we need to know? What is it we need to have reported? And what is it, you know, what is it that the job of the auditor needs to be in order to play that critical role? Because they really were the dogs that didn't bark. They weren't the only ones, but certainly we need to examine that.
Well, before, actually, hold on, Judge, for a sec. But before we get to responding to your comments and statements, I would like to stick with the Fraud Center for just, you know, another 5 or 10 minutes. And I know that, Meredith, you have some ideas on that. Lynn, you clearly have. And Joe, you have. And Bob Burns on our staff is taking the lead on that. And I think that the more you can input here, you know, we can help define the Fraud Center, and then we can broadly discuss the other issues. So why don't the three of you and anybody else comment on your views of the Fraud Center, and then Judge will recognize you. Meredith, you want to?
I'll start that out. I think the Fraud Center has great promise, but I think we need to be careful with expectations. I see it as a device that will do postmortems on what I'm going to call audit failures. Though auditors would probably argue that we're following the audit standards, and unless something shows up in our sample, in our confirmations, we're clean. Well, I think that requires an attitude adjustment. And I think by doing a series of postmortems, and hopefully using the safe harbor sort of approach that Ann suggests, they can be done on a relatively timely basis, so we don't have to wait for all the court cases to be cleared before we can sit down and say what went wrong, what might have been done different, how might we have alerted the investment public. And I think over time, by going through this exercise, I think that there will be a mindset change for auditors. And I think the so-called expectation gap between the investment community and the audit community might be significantly narrowed. But I don't think that just is going to be movement on the part of the investment community. I think there will have to be movement on the part of the audit community, too, and perhaps the PCAOB will have to take a good, strong look at the results that come out of the audits, the findings that come out of the Fraud Center, and perhaps there will be a need to redirect the audit effort to have more of a focus on fraud to serve the investment public. I think those are my comments. I think it's very important, but I think it's a long-term sort of effort. We're not going to turn around in the next 30, 60, 90 days. It's a long-term education effort.
Joe, Lynn?
I, first of all, applaud the
board for moving forward on this. I think it's the right thing to do. I am a little disappointed in the scope. I think the, at least as I've read the scope, I think the board has pretty clearly just mimicked what was in the ACAP report. And as you can tell from some of the comments that you've received, particularly from Bob Roper, Meredith, myself, Lynn, probably others, that there was a hope that the board might do more. As I understand it, essentially the aim of this center is to share fraud prevention and detection experiences, practices, data, and commission research. Well, when you think about sharing fraud prevention and detection experiences and practices, I think to some extent that's already going on now between the major firms at the CAQ, so it's not obvious to me that this body needs to do that. There's a large body of research on fraud that's going on and sponsored by academic institutions and other bodies. If you wanted to have a commission research, you put money out there, you'll get research done. One of the major problems in this area, and this is, I think, what Damon was alluding to, is data is confidential, both at the level of the board and at the level of the individual firms. And unless all the research is going to be done by this fraud center and tightly controlled in terms of dissemination, which kind of defeats the point, unless you're able to deal with the issue of confidentiality of data, you have a problem. I think there had been a hope on my part, and as I said, as well as others, that the Fraud Center might be able to go a little bit further than even what I've just discussed, and that is to essentially replicate the National Transportation Safety Board. And when there's a major fraud, not necessarily every fraud, but a major fraud, particularly where the auditor has culpability, particularly in, let's say, a 102E case, 102E case, or even if they are alleged to have a fraud responsibility beyond 102E, that the fraud center would go in and there'd have to be some sort of safe harbor, as Ann talked about, and do a detailed examination of what happened there with the objective, really, of informing the board in terms of standard setting. The board, one of the advantages the board has that no other standard setter has is the ability to get access to data that other parties can't, right now through your inspection program. But if you structure the fraud center in a certain manner, you'd be able to get data and information as to how the fraud happened, what could have been done to prevent the fraud, and where did the auditors fail. I'm not talking about failure necessarily from a legal liability perspective, but what could they have done that might have uncovered the fraud, detected the fraud, ultimately leading to better standards, ultimately leading to better inspections, and then ultimately leading to better financial reporting. And I think that's, at the end of the day, what you guys care about.
Steve, when I go back and look at all the cases, the big names that we've had in the paper, WaMu, Countrywide, Lehman, Merrill Bear, AIG, New Century, Wachovia, Citigroup, GM, Freddie and Fannie, with perhaps the exception of New Century, no one has said the financial statements were misstated. They have all been claims, including the SEC's claims and enforcement actions to date, have all been around disclosure issues. And one might say, especially coming out of the Enron and WorldCom time period and periods before that, that in fact the auditors did do a much better job this time than what they did in the past. I think if that's the case, it's probably due to at least in part the PCAOB and its inspections. But this go around, I think the fraud was much more subtle, if you will. It wasn't the type of Enron or WorldCom multi-billion dollar cooking of the books. It's more a repeat of what we had two decades ago with the SNL crisis that I know a number of us around the table here turned around and lived through with the commissioner or elsewhere. And so to that extent, I think the Fraud Center is an excellent idea, because I think that's exactly why you have the Fraud Center, to turn around and go in and dissect these cases, find out what really went wrong, and what can be learned from that, and more importantly, what should be done to make the system work better going forward. Sometimes that's happened in the past, but often, and I can count no less than at least six of such episodes during my career, quite often we don't go back and get those things or haven't gotten those things fixed. So I think if you have a fraud center that actually looks at this stuff, dissects it, tries to find the lessons learned, and then also comes forward with recommendations, I think if you don't have the recommendation part to it, you're really missing the boat big time here. But I think as long as you got that, then it will provide an enormous benefit and will be well worth whatever the costs are to that system. So, but I do think the lessons that we'll find from this one are much more subtle than what we've had in the past, which, going on to the lessons learned part of this discussion, I think if there is a lesson that we've learned here, it goes back to something that I remember Warren Buffett telling me and Chairman Levitt at the time. And Warren said, we should, and certainly in the audit committee rooms, we should be asking the question of the auditor, what is it that the auditor knows that they were investing in this company they would want to know and have out there publicly? And yet that type of information never came out of the auditor at companies like AIG, like New Century, like Lehman, Fannie and Freddie, where it was very clear there was very material information, very important information. A particular FASB standard or SEC standard hadn't been written on it, and yet, and as a result, wasn't necessarily required, despite the SEC's disclosure requirements for material information. And the auditors sat there and did nothing with it. So if there was one major lesson here, I think we see it in the Veloukis report in spades, that is, we've got to come up with some scheme whereby if the auditor is sitting on that type of information, is aware of it, somehow that he has to either disclose it himself or force that disclosure. Certainly the number one lesson that I get out of this from the auditor side of it.
Judge, you had a comment.
Well, there's no question that the fraud center makes sense, but what does concern me, and I think Ann hit on it, was the role of the auditor. What we don't hear anything about what happened. I look at partially of what happened. I always look, because of my judicial background, the key to the case. What's the key to this case? And one of the keys is in the is why is this case with the securitized mortgages much different than the salad oil case? In the salad oil case, there was no salad oil. Here we had mortgages that were either made out of air, if they're called synthetic, or we had very low value mortgages. And someone said, well, there was some rating agency that said these were good mortgages. And the accountant said, well, buy that. Why? Accountants are not supposed to buy because somebody else says something. Am I right or wrong? Look at the cases that you found where valuation was a big issue. Again, isn't that an auditor's role to see if the assets are there? And why? And that's why I'm trying to figure out, if we're going to have the fraud center, why aren't we going to look to see why, what beyond just the rating agency who was looking at these things? And if somebody said there was no value to these mortgages or very low value, why were we treating it? I think the answer might be that the auditors were looking back instead of forward. I just think they got to look to see where, you know, we got a new instrument we're creating here, and yet we're having trouble figuring out how to deal with it. Instead, we're looking at these rules, and all those rules, I love, I'm glad I was with the CIA because I could figure out the code, what you were saying before, because otherwise you got to break that code of all these numbers that we're talking about. So that's what I'm trying to, by having all these numbers that we're looking at, did it comply with this, did it comply with that, we're missing the big picture. We're missing the forest because of the trees. In my Keating case, when the accountants were telling me because the Keating's bank was financing someone buying a property from it for $13 million when the cost was $1 million, and because somebody, one of the clients of the bank, put the $2 million up or give it to 25%, it was okay because they followed the rules. But nobody said, looked at the guy that bought it. It was a guy they picked off the streets of Phoenix and brought him into a room and says, you now own this property and here's $50,000 for your help. And that was the deal. And nobody said, well, does this make economic sense? And again, it seems to me that they're frauds. Somebody's got to look to see whether we should have been examining those mortgages or those portfolios and finding out, you know, the accountant saying, yeah, these don't have that. We understand that somebody put a rating on this, but so what? But looking ahead, not back all the time, not look back. These were the rules at the time. Look ahead. The accountant's got to have creativity as much as anybody else. It might make any sense. I don't know what the heck you get.
Well, you are with Brandon. Let me. We'll open it up. I'd love to ask you some questions, but I want to hear from everybody, or we want to hear from everybody. But Brandon, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll just
a quick observation. I agree with everything generally that's been said about the fraud center, its importance, and including the judge's comments. But I do think, without trying to put too much value on nominalism, calling it a fraud center is a mistake. Because if you limit yourself to instances of found fraud, you're going to miss exactly what the judge is describing. What happens when the industry follows the rules as articulated, follows appropriate standards in valuing synthetic CDOs, but it turns out that the procedures that were followed didn't work. So I'm just as interested in an assessment of after the crash, to use the NTSB example. It may be that the design of the roadbed was wrong, and somebody should go off and figure out whether there is someone we're going to hold culpable for it. That's an interesting question. But as a passenger on the train, what's more important to me is that the roadbeds get fixed, and that on a going forward basis, we know how to design the roadbed. Somebody else can go do the enforcement job of that, but we need to be able to look at how we set our guidelines for best practices, even in situations that don't rise to the level of fraud. And I'm afraid that if we only look for fraud, bad actors who did the wrong thing under articulated standards, we will miss the far more, or at least equally significant situations where good people follow the right standards and the best practices, and they go off the cliff like lemmings.
Norman. Just by way of brief follow-up, Steve, I think that each of the three, Brandon, Lynn, and Judge Bork, and all were getting at this point, but I wanted to just make it a little more clear. I think, again, I agree in concept that the idea of a fraud center or an organization designed to conduct an analysis of factors coming out of a major fraud or crisis is a good idea. I think the trick always with exercises or initiatives of this sort is, I think we've demonstrated a real talent as a profession, as regulators, our Congress, all who've looked at the Enron, WorldCom frauds, or the frauds of the past. We all do a very good job of solving the last crime. And I think that Lynn is right that, you know, we're unlikely to see another fraud that involves a massive mischaracterization of operating expenses. We're unlikely to see another fraud like an Enron or Repco that involves massive abuse of off-balance sheet transactions related to party entities. So those aren't going to happen again because those are, you know, we know what those are now. We know what they look like, and you know, gosh darn, we're going to be sure they never happen again. I think the real trick is to take, is to conduct the autopsy, the forensics, the analysis, and identify the lessons that should have been learned. The trick is figuring out areas in our economy, in industries, where there are circumstances afoot that give rise to new risks, and applying the lessons that we learned from the past in a preemptive way to try to head off crises or frauds or misdeeds that may be in their infancy. I think that's the real challenge. I think it's doable, but it requires a tremendous amount of thought and analysis and awareness of what lies ahead as opposed to what has occurred in the past.
Tony, and then Bonnie, and then Gus.
Just wanted to point out, make a comment on what Brandon said, that focusing on fraud or identified frauds is a problem or is not likely to help. I remember many years ago a study was sent to me, and it purported to talk about whether cash flows were the bottom line. And what it did was said, let's see if cash flows are good or accruals are good predictors of bankruptcy. Well, the problem is that bankruptcies are negotiated. They're not, you know, it's not something that you can observe in a way, because if through negotiations you manage to avoid it, that doesn't mean cash flows did not catch the problem. So these people, for example, the authors of the study had said that in the 70s, because Chrysler and Massey Ferguson did not declare bankruptcy at certain points in time, cash flows were misleading. Now, when you look at it that way, it's a very stupid statement to say that they were misleading. So fraud, unfortunately, as Brandon points out, may not be the right way to go about it. We need to look at it far more critically and think of this thing differently in order to understand the lessons of this.
I was trying to think how I would use all this information in the boardroom. You know, when something happens, the first thing that comes up is, where was the board of directors? And if we're all sitting around here trying to figure out perhaps where the next best fraud will be, it makes it extremely difficult for us when we're dealing with issues that come before us, particularly if you're looking back, which is a good thing. Yes, let's look back and see what took place, I think, as the judge had said. But I will tell you that I don't believe the next best fraud is going to be one that has already been perpetuated, and that, you know, so everyone's looking out for that, and now you just move on to something new. I think the idea of a center is a good idea, but I think more forward-looking, and in terms of how I, as a board member, take a look at what is being presented to me, and I'm depending on the experts who are the auditors, who've been working with the internal auditors, and somehow or another, now I'm suspect of that. So where is the next best place to go? So I think when we talk about the tools that are necessary to review what is brought before a board and how you look at it, you know, in the deep dive, particularly where fraud is possible and where it may come from, it just gets to be one of those things that I hope there's, as we have our discussions today, there will be some tools to help directors take a look at what's brought before them as well.
I'd like to address some of the comments. Brandon mentioned the fact that there are skeptics that, about a fraud prevention center, and I think those people are talking about the enormity of the problem, the fact that a lot of the analysis is basically back testing and you know, perhaps data mining in terms that we use in research. Nevertheless, I think it's important that we glean whatever information we can, that even if it's very difficult to project going forward, as a number of people talked about, it's important to learn what we can and to change audit standards, as Joe mentioned, to change practices. Perhaps there would be a world of information that could be utilized by FASB as well in setting up the accounting standards. I think there's a lot that could be shared there. I think it's important that even if it's a very difficult effort, if we can shrink the size of the fraud box that's very worthwhile. So we think that those that say or that are skeptical about it really don't recognize the advantages. I would agree with what many people have said, that things have to be forward-looking, that we need to try to figure out how to minimize not only fraud, but misrepresentation of full financial information. And so we would fully support a fraud center.
Bob, and then I see that there are a number of labels on, so clearly somebody's hit a nerve.
Thank you, Steve. Bob Tirola. It strikes me that obviously there needs to be a type of postmortem on frauds and the PCAOB regarding where the audit lapses may have occurred is the right place. But within the managements in the boardroom, there are every quarter the CEO and CFO are signing off on the financial statements, certifying their accuracy, certifying that any matters of a fraud or concern were brought to the attention of the audit committee and the board. It seems like as a system we don't trust that part of the reporting process. That the certifications of officers are less important than the opinion of an auditor. And that seems to me exists because we don't really think that the internal process is professional, whereas the examination process, the auditor examination process, is professional, and it's professional because this board insists that it be professional. If we're really going to protect investors, we need to do it at the source. We will not be able to review in or audit in quality. The quality really has to be, there has to be trust in the system that there's quality reporting coming from the companies and that there's quality auditing to make sure that it stays that way. So a fraud center is great. But I think professionalization of preparation of financial information is even a better way to avoid bad reporting in the future.
Pete?
Great. Thanks, Steve. A lot of good things have been said, and just not everybody said them. So I wanted to add a couple things maybe to what others have already focused on that I think are really good ideas. One, Lynn mentioned the fact that despite his long list of companies that we all recognize, either are failed or failing out of the last crisis, really hasn't been any misstatements that have arisen from the financial statements, at least not yet. Yet I don't think any of us would look at the financial situations of those organizations based on what investors could know at the time and say that the financial statements weren't misleading, because how could that many companies kind of all of a sudden go down in a crash? And I do think, as Bob said, the certification process, I do think helps. I've sat across the table from people in my prior life as an auditor where they got really crystallized, and focused on their personal risk when they had to sign something. I think that process is great, and I think it has helped in terms of not helping to prevent misstatements. But on the other hand, in terms of misleading, I think, that's the next step we have to get to, and how do we do it? I think a lot of it is about the risks, and I'm not blessed or cursed with being a lawyer, but I've worked with lots of lawyers on designing risk disclosures in public filings, and they tend to be very voluminous. They tend to be very articulate, but in a very legal form as opposed to plain English. And I know there's some people like us around the table that are required to, by plain English standards, to describe and disclose things to their investors. And the question is, can we help, foster that a little bit, whether it's coming out of this fraud center or something else we might label it, as to how do we better inform the public and the investing public about what the risks are in the business. And then that feeds to the second point, which I think a lot of what happened here was it wasn't just the massive frauds like the McKesson's, the salad oil thing, where a really bad operator did something really bad and probably should have been caught but wasn't. But I think the lessons, or one of the lessons that came out of this last crisis, is we kind of had a systemic, I don't know if you want to call it failure, but bad design. So, and there are many different parts of the financial system you can look at, but just looking at subprime mortgages or just mortgage securitization in general. We went from a day where back in the S&L days, at least the S&L originated the loan and they had to hold it. Now, they may still have originated bad loans, but at least, you know, the guy that was going to kind of service the loan sat right down the hall from the person that originated it. The CEO who's going to have to report the financial results knew that that stuff was staying in the house. So if it was toxic, it presumably gave you some pause. And instead, we went from that over the course of two decades of setting up a system where the originator originated. They, you know, may have sold it to some warehouse lender who then in turn sold it to somebody who was going to securitize it, who then sold it to somebody in Norway. And it became impossible, you know, through that, not impossible, but during the course of all that, little, you know, well-meaning people just doing wickedly difficult jobs and probably 70, 80 hours a week, cutting corners here and there. And by the time you cut enough corners off, four or five steps in the process, the product that ended up at the back end was garbage. And it was very difficult to find that out because we had the imprimaturs of either auditors or rating agencies or others along the way. And this is where I think, again, a fraud center or some sort of financial reporting center that gets at not just bad operators but systemic risk could be helpful.
I just want to ask a quick question.
Have the auditors changed what they're doing based upon, we don't need a fraud center to tell us what we know now. Are they changing what they're doing? Do we know that? Do we know whether did they learn anything from this? I mean, have they changed the way they do business? Is there an auditor that can answer that question? Where are the auditors here?
You need the SAG, right?
I'm an auditor, and if I understand the question right, there's not been any change in what they're required to do, which is validate existence, fair valuation, and proper disclosure of the assets and what's included in the financial statements. Now, were they doing that is a different question, but what they're required to do to follow their auditing standards says, yes, you are right, Judge. They have to get comfortable that assets exist and they are fairly stated and are properly disclosed. I'm not sure that was consistently being done.
Joe, why don't we go right down and then around the table. And then, Kelvin, I know that this was not a priority of yours, but everybody else has spoken. So before we leave this panel, I want to, you know, give you, if not the last word, a word. I'm sorry, Charlie.
No, that's okay. I'm just going to respond to Judge Sporkin and just add a little something to what's been said. And that is that when we talk about disclosure, I think it causes all of us, especially as a regulator of the audit profession, to particularly focus on the words in the audit opinion that often are not focused on, and that is fairly presented. In conformity with GAAP is one thing. Maybe it's not misstated that it is in conformity with GAAP, but fairly presented is also extremely important. And if what you have is financial statements that are misleading, that are in conformity with GAAP, then I would say, how can they be fairly presented? And really, when you talk about have auditors learn some, I think auditors are very mindful today that, you know, of what happened. But it also means it's a wake-up call, I think, for all of us as a part of the system to focus on the words, that what is material? And it's hard to define materiality when you're talking about words, but we have to recognize that if those words aren't right, if the disclosures aren't there, then the financial statements are not fairly presented if it's misleading. And that's... Anyway,
I want to hit a couple of things, and I'll try to do it quickly. Bob talked about how investors often don't rely on CEO and CFO certifications as it relates to fraud, and if you don't get the preparer right, you don't get the whole system right. And I agree with him. I think he's right. I think part of the problem, though, Bob, is when you look at fraud in the study that we did in the late 90s, 83% of the frauds that resulted in enforcement actions, the CEO and or the CFO was involved. In the study that's going to come out in a few weeks, as the PCAOB and the SEC knows because we've briefed them, in frauds from 1998 through 2007 that resulted in an SEC enforcement action, 89% of the time the CEO or the CFO is involved. And so when it comes to fraud, right? Who's going to hurt you? It's going to be the CEO or the CFO. Not in most companies. In most companies, they're honest, competent people. But where you have risk, that's generally where you have the risk. So I think that's part of the problem. There was a number of comments that the past won't repeat itself. And I do think the flavor of fraud changes a little bit. But the past does repeat itself, guys. It's top management. If auditors could do a better job of assessing the CEO and the CFO's integrity, they wouldn't need liability reform. And in terms of revenue recognition, in our 90 study, 50% of the frauds involved improper revenue recognition. In the study that's coming out in a few weeks, 60%. And most of the frauds are not complex Enron-type frauds. They're plain vanilla, cutoff issues, just making up revenue transactions, very basic stuff that everybody in the room could easily understand. Last thing, very quickly, performance of the profession. I would second Lynn and a couple of others who said things. If you go back to earlier this decade, just to remind everybody in the room, WorldCom, Enron, Adelphia, Global Crossing, Tyco, on and on, HealthSouth. It was essentially a fraud a week, a financial statement fraud a week. And if you look at the depth of the recession coming out of the dot-com bubble, it was significantly less severe than what we've experienced now. And if you would say, based on the magnitude of the recession now vis-a-vis what we had 10 years ago, we should have had 100, 200 financial statement frauds. We haven't had that. As Lynn pointed out, and I agree, most of what we've had are disclosure issues, even when there have been allegations. There have been issues where maybe the business model wasn't sustainable. The auditor might have known that. The auditor hasn't done anything. I've had people ask me, and this is obviously something that should be of concern to the SEC and the PCAOB, obviously 404 has failed because risk assessment was very poorly done. And then you explain to people, take the COSO framework, slice out two-thirds of it, because all 404A and 404B does is talk about internal control over financial reporting. Are the GAAP standards that are set in Norwalk, Connecticut, are they correctly applied? That's really all the auditor is saying. As it relates to the failure of risk management, that's operating effectiveness and efficiency and compliance with laws, rules, and regulations. It's not primarily a financial reporting issue. So I'm not saying that there aren't issues that we should look at as a society, at the PCAOB, at the SEC, and at the FASB. But I think in general, the profession actually acquitted themselves, certainly vis-a-vis the other players in this crisis, like rating agencies, significantly better than many. And I think, not to be obsequious, I think a large amount of that credit goes to the board and their activities.
Can I piggyback on what Joe said, because he sort of stole my thunder? Yeah, I would agree with Joe as well as Lynn, the fact that we need to look both historically at the types of frauds and improper practices that took place, because as you have new management coming on board, 30-year-old CEO, he may not remember what took place 20 or 30 years ago, and he may be repeating the same improper practice. Also, as you have new audit staff come on board, some of the new auditors may not recognize some of these old frauds that took place, but they may be repeating themselves. And I think that the frauds will probably be detected faster or sooner by the PCAOB when they come in and actually inspect the audit firms and what they've done, but I still think the frauds will repeat themselves.
Just really quickly, because I think we're all in agreement that it seems like there's some benefit for a fraud center that might be backward-looking, and then obviously this forward-looking issue is of core importance to everybody here. And I think I have a question about whether that is really the fraud center's job or it's the board's job on a going forward basis. And I think clearly the markets evolve constantly, and staying ahead of the markets is just such a challenge. And, Judge, I wanted to follow up on your comment and your question. And I guess I want to share a frustration, I think, from the investor side, which is I appreciate the due diligence that needs to go into whether it's accounting standard setting or audit standard setting, but I think the glacial pace sometimes of those activities means that the market just moves way ahead of you, and by the time the standards are released, there's something else to be worrying about. So I guess I would encourage you, and that's something I have in my written statement, in terms of issuing staff guidance on hot issues, I think, in a rapid way. I think that's a value, great value to the auditing profession, and I think to the investing public at large. I'm sorry, just very quickly. I'm never sure about resource issues for the PCOB, and I probably should know this, but I guess it goes without saying, and I don't know, Commissioner, if this should be directed at you, that the PCOB should have the resources. I think, you know, I'm very supportive of the Fraud Center, and I hope that this doesn't mean you're robbing, they have to rob Peter to pay Paul to get this set up, and that the board can develop whatever strategy it needs and articulate a budget and get the resources that it needs to get this up and running in a way that's beneficial to everybody.
And then as we go around the table, because we've got about 15 minutes left to this panel, I mean, you made a specific recommendation that I heard, and that is you applaud the audit alerts, whereby we get ahead of the curve, or at least we're putting the industry on notice. But if all of you can kind of begin to summarize your recommendations in as we go around this panel that way, it would be very helpful. Lynn?
Steve, Ann got ahead of me on one of the things I was going to say, and that is PCOB does have a risk management office right now that does look forward. So from that perspective, people need to realize that function is already in the PCOB, and they have identified, along with other staff in the PCOB, issues. Just 2 weeks ago in this town, the chief auditor teed up the fact that we've got a couple hundred Chinese companies listed in, incorporated in Bermuda and audited by someone in Buffalo, New York, that doesn't speak Chinese. And so clearly, they're doing that. They're trying to find the next problem and appropriately trying to deal with it in a timely basis. So that's not something that's lacking in the current system. It's something that is in the system, and the PCOB has worked on it. With respect to the loan issue, one has to keep in mind, too, I think Stanley, the judge, raised a lot of good questions about where were the auditors on the loans, but you also have to recognize that the regulators in this town, especially the banking regulators, have basically come in and bludgeoned, with the help of some very influential people in Congress, bludgeoned the auditors to death to make sure that losses absolutely were not taken. And so the regulators sent a very strong message to the auditors, go very carefully here, and that it makes it extremely difficult for an auditor to stand up then and start telling people to all of a sudden take losses. So it wasn't just an auditor question. It's where were the banking regulators that were, along with Congress, beating these people up, and we probably haven't seen all the losses yet on the loan, and that, quite frankly, is why we haven't seen a bunch of restatements come out in that area that probably should have otherwise come out. The other thing, talking about lessons learned, we do know that time and time again, the number one way we find these frauds is not from internal auditors, it's not from external auditors, it's from the whistleblowers inside the companies by 3, 4, 5 times higher rate than internal auditors and external auditors. And yet today, the auditing standards by which the profession has to practice doesn't mention and doesn't require the auditor to even look or understand that system. And sitting on audit committees, I have time and time again sat there and asked the audit partner to describe to me exactly how our whistleblower program works, how the issues are resolved, you know, tell me about whether it's really independent or not. And I'm talking with some big four auditors. Not in a single case has the partner ever been able to describe that for me. So it's very clear there are lessons to be learned. It'll be interesting to see what Joe's report has to say about that. But it'll be very, you know, the bottom line is there are lessons to be learned and incorporated in the standards, and we haven't done a good job so far today.
Thank you. I think I've got two comments because people have covered a lot of the points extremely well. And the first is that really there needs to be a way for the Fraud Center to capture foolishness not just criminal behavior. And so I don't know how we do that. There's an old saying in English, you know, to be ruined by a fool is the same as to be ruined by a knave, you know, and foolishness. So greed and stupidity probably played as much of a role in bringing us to the brink as out-and-out attempts at criminal behavior. So, and on that, I just wanted to flag something that that CalPERS is doing, is in an effort to try and understand in our own portfolio why some banks where we're owners did better than others. And so we're actually involved in a whole series of meetings with the boards of companies, not just the ones where it went wrong, but where things went right. Back to your point, Bonnie. What did they do so that they didn't become, you know, foolish, greedy, you know, drink the Kool-Aid with the rest of the pushers of these products? And I think out of that we'll get something that may be useful in Anne's idea, which I like very much, which is that we can issue some, or you could issue some guidance notes. You know, actually things like the structure of compensation makes a big difference to risk, and should the auditors be paying attention there? We know that's not, you know, something that's on the table. Should we be looking at far more carefully at reporting lines and specifying what the auditors' roles are, not just in a 404 style idea of internal controls and financial reporting, but I think the mindset issue is the problem, that we've actually got a structure in which auditors in particular, because of the litigation and liability issue, are on a compliance track. And a lot of the problems that we're facing are not about compliance, they're about the real substance of what's going on. So how we get to that, where it's the spirit, not the legal letter of the law, I think is the biggest challenge that we're facing.
I think we do know that the economic crisis was not caused by poor audits, that it was poor mortgages that led to a financial crisis, that led to an economic crisis. So there are really two issues here left on the auditing side. I think by and large audits serve us well in doing what they are prescribed to do to date. I do think it's important to establish a fraud center that is actually focusing on fraud, not focusing on other issues as well. Well, there is a separate issue other than fraud, and it's been discussed here, and that's really incomplete information. Are we getting the true picture? And I think on average, we have gotten the true picture. The problem is there's a distribution around that picture. There are plenty of scenarios where AIG does not fail. And on average, perhaps AIG does not fail. But we experience the tail of the event. And I think that's where auditors can help us. Totally separate from the fraud that we're talking about, but they could help us understand the risk of the audit. And I think we'll tease this more out later in a later session. And I think that should be handled separately. So I would prefer to not see fraud try to encompass everything, try to be totally forward-looking, try to analyze whether or not we're getting complete information. If it's accurate information, that's the important thing. But we need to understand the tail. What is the risk to us that the AIG scenario does play out? So I think hopefully we're going to tease that out later today.
Tony?
I wanted to take a slightly different tack to some of the comments that have been made. I remain unconvinced that the auditors have done a good job. What do we think when, or how should we view companies that are serial restaters? What do you do when a company, one of the largest companies in this country in the last 3 or 4 years, has had to restate several times? We look at companies, as Joe has pointed out, where revenue recognition today is about 60%. You said it used to be 50%. We never think about impairments, for example. Consider the number of goodwill impairments. Companies make acquisitions, and generally speaking, from the research that I've seen, they effectively end up writing off the goodwill within 18 months of the acquisition. If more than 70% of the acquisition's goodwill gets written off that quickly, what are the resulting numbers? What do they mean afterwards? You bought an asset from someone, paid them $10, written off 8 of it, and afterwards you sell it for 3 and you announce that you have a profit of 50%. is that really not misleading? Is it really, does that mean that we're now fairly presenting this information as Charlie was asking? Or as Judge was asking, what are the auditors doing? If you look at the specifics of the way in which material information is presented, I think there are other ways, other problems that we have. And that's what I meant when I said earlier that I used the example of bankruptcy. The fact that someone doesn't announce bankruptcy, but the investors lose all the money that they've invested in that company, I think is pretty bad. I don't care if they don't declare bankruptcy. We've lost the money. There ought to be some way of looking at that, and we've got to try to think of it from that perspective.
I would ask everybody, I've been reminded, if everybody could introduce them, put their name up, since this is being webcast. It's not clear who's speaking. But just following up on your point, Tony, which I think is an extremely good one with respect to the impairment of goodwill and other issues which you brought up, what would you have the PCAOB do that we're not doing? What specific recommendations would you make on the issues that you've raised?
I think the issue is that we need to find a way to be able to talk about what effect that has on financial statements. So if there are, in effect, as I said, serial restatements, if there are certainly repetitions of impairments or adjustments to the financial statements, there has to be a way of asking, what is it that was wrong? Is it internal controls? Is it the fact that we're not actually following the accounting standards? As Joe pointed out, if you look at the number of revenue recognition restatements that you see, you have to ask yourself, is it really that complex? But Joe also pointed out that some of the errors with respect to revenue recognition are fairly simple. How is it possible that we continue to miss that? I found a company the other day that says their auditors have permitted them to apply the multiple element arrangement accounting standard on service transactions, but hasn't asked them to apply it to products. The first line of that standard says that it applies to everything. It starts off actually by saying this standard applies to everything. It doesn't fool around. It doesn't say it in any complex language or anything. How do you do that for 7 years? So those are the kind of, there has to be some way of asking auditors and or finding a way in the financial statements. I think, as Charlie said, what is the meaning of fairly presented if I end up with 17 restatements? By the way, I speak of the impairments on basis of having done a fairly extensive study of impairments several years ago. And the repetition of those impairments is just extraordinary. So the specific recommendations, I think we'd have to find a way to be able to talk about these restatements and these impairments.
Bob, and then we've got about 7 more minutes on this panel, so Mike, we'll get to you definitely. Well, we'll get to everybody, and then we'll wrap up. But if you could be fairly brief. And then, actually, Brandon, I think I'd like to give you the last word because you made some very specific recommendations in your statement. So why don't we spend a little bit more than the 7 minutes and we'll go right around and conclude. Bob.
Bob Tirola. Thank you, Steve. In the way of recommendations, I would encourage the board to look at the audit function more closely around what boards and managements have to satisfy for SEC requirements or otherwise. To Charlie's point earlier about financial statements being fairly stated, the officer certification says fairly stated. It doesn't say in conformity with GAAP. It stops at fairly stated. That was wise on the SEC's part to truncate that statement. Secondly, I met with auditing firms a few times now, and the topic was, what can we do to, as a CFO and a board member, what can we do to help you? And my answer generally has been focus on the 80% of the things I do, not just on the 20%. The 20% around keeping the books right is fine, but the 80% around risk management, around whistleblowing monitoring, around monitoring operating controls and regulatory controls, around whether or not the business model is still working. Those are the risks that managements and boards are looking at. The auditor is not. The interesting thing is that the disclosure model now requires boards and managements to talk about all of that, whether it's risk factors or enterprise risk management approaches or compensation models. All of that is now in the public domain, yet the auditors almost spend no or very little time assessing those disclosures. And those are the disclosures that mean as much to investors as the accuracy of the balance sheet today, because these are the factors that are going to affect the accuracy of the balance sheet tomorrow.
No, we're asking the questions.
I'm asking a very simple question. Do we know what the auditors do when they look at a securitized mortgage? Do we know what they do? They tell us what they do. If they tell us what they do, and then we find out, did they find it or didn't they find it? If they didn't, then they got to change. And I don't know why we're making this thing so complex and the boards. What did the auditors do here? You're an auditor. You're looking at auditing. Did they properly audit something? When your people go in, are they going to ask you, what did they do when they looked at a securitized mortgage? Did they look at it? Did they look at the rating and then give up? Or did they go beyond that? And if they didn't go beyond that, should they go beyond that? Is that, those hard questions?
Well, I think they're extremely tough questions. I mean, at the end of the day, and I want to get back to you, but not in this session. But during your Keating opinion, you asked the fundamental question: where were the watchdogs? And I remember that vividly.
Right.
And we'll get back to that later on today. But I think it's a very difficult question to figure out exactly what the role of the watchdog is.
What did they do? We don't know what they did. Let's find out what they did.
Well. I think that's part and parcel of what we're getting at directly with respect to one of the items the fraud center is going to be looking at. So let's keep on going around, and we'll have to wrap this one up pretty shortly, but let's take the extra time so that we hear from everybody.
Just to, I have to applaud and appreciate comments Bob and Joe both have made, and this is Mike Head to get back to announcing, that when you talk about, and I call it the iceberg theory, I've done that for years. That may not make any sense to other people, but what I mean by iceberg theory is the financial statements are what's above water when you're talking about an iceberg. And it's the smallest piece of what's going on. So Bob and Joe are alluding to, in the full COSO framework, where you have financial reporting, operating efficiency and effectiveness, and compliance with applicable laws and regulations, the iceberg, part of the iceberg you can see is the financial reporting. A lot of us that are historical accountants and auditors will call that the scorekeeping, are very important because it's what investors see and rely on in making their decisions. But where you manage risk, where governance is implemented, where you are trying to prevent fraud and hold management accountable and the board is trying to do what they're saying, that's the large portion of that iceberg is the operating procedures and the compliance portions that, by design, the auditor's opinion is not intended to cover except indirectly. And it's why one of the things from a broker-dealer point of view, that as things from the whatever center you set up or you're talking about trying to influence what auditors can do, that's why a SAS 70 type of approach, and why I applaud where the SEC went with the custodial rules and modifying it. If there's something that management, boards, PCAOB, and the SEC feels are critical for the safeguarding of assets and the protection of the investors, to get at that, you can't do that through the financial statements and an audit opinion of the financial statements. You have to look at it at the operational and compliance control structure, and the best way to get to that is not through the vehicle of material misstatement and fair statement of financial statements. It's by doing a service audit that it falls under the SAS 70 Type 2 audit. So if we think custody controls is where we're really concerned about protecting investors' assets, then you require them to do a SAS 70 covering a period that's covering the operating and compliance procedures, and you don't try to get at that through the financial statements. If someone thinks there's elements that come out of the postmortem of this fraud stuff that are critical to protect the investors, and it's operational relied upon, then you go to something like the SEC custodial rules, and you put a rule in place that requires management and the auditing firm to look at the controls around those operating procedures. And if governance and compensation are things that hit that hot button, then you include them in a required audit of operating procedures, not try to get at it through just disclosure and financial statement presentation. You'll never get there. And that's what you and Joe are saying, Bob, but that's not what a financial statement audit opinion is trying to give you comfort on. A SAS 70 or other targeted controls are. FINRA put into place a few years ago the requirement for the compliance structure to be certified and reported on. If you took 404 and expanded it to be, we want you to opine on the COSO framework and not make it a point in time at year end, but to make it for the operating year of the for the company, and you made it cover financial operating and compliance and turn that into a service type audit for the company, and you would get much further than trying to disclose the world in the financial statements. But that's just me. I'll get off my soapbox.
Pete, we do welcome your comment, even though you...
Okay, I'll try and keep it brief. Otherwise, I was going to cede my time to the gentleman from Teachers, since I know you wanted to end where you began. But just two quick things on practical guidance. I think, you know, since the beginning of time, in terms of looking at fraud, it's almost always been hidden in the same places. So, you know, as somebody said earlier, unrealized gains, or it's stuck in inventory, you know, et cetera. How do we come up with, you know, the practical guidance, and particularly gets at the new things that are always being created, whether being created on Wall Street or being created other places, because there's a reason, you know, the Madoff scandal was referred to as a Ponzi scheme. You know, we've talked a bit about things are new, but, you know, Ponzi's been around for 100 years. So what can we learn from the old ones, but then how do we stay on the leading edge of the new ones? And then lastly, we talk a lot about risk and risk disclosures, and, you know, how can the PCAOB collaborate with other standard setters and regulatory bodies to come up with some sort of a framework around risk disclosures. Again, it's not necessarily up to the auditors to disclose those in the financials. Maybe we should ask them to disclose it in their opinions, but I think having management disclose it in their financials and having the auditors responsible for reviewing risk disclosure, I think, could be helpful.
Well, we're clearly going to get to that a little bit later. Brandon?
I think it's Kierkegaard who said something like, life is understood looking backwards but lived going forward. It seems to me that your advisory committee universally supports a fraud center and urges you to implement it promptly and robustly. We also support it focusing on old-time fraud, whether it's Ponzi or salad oil, and looking for ways to make sure that we avoid those instances again. We also think that in terms of lessons learned, whether it's Lynn's more subtle problems, Ann's structural issues, or Tony's individual concerns, that there are more important concerns that go beyond fraud, or at least of equal importance, which go to risk and its measurement and the assessment of risk above and beyond the focus on the financial statements. The ability to make sure that fairly presented appropriately incorporates an assessment of risk is an important aspect that we would hope to see a fraud center, or as Anne might amend that, a fools and fraud center would take into consideration on a going forward basis. We also, at least at TIA CREF, think that looking at some particulars, even if you don't take on the entire comprehensive assessment, whether it's Rule 105 or the quality of earnings, and in our view, whether or not we're picking up the entire earnings life cycle of a financial instrument are areas that warrant further consideration on a going forward basis. But the core message, I think, of your group is we need a fraud center that's robust, and we need to not only deal with regular way fraud, we need to deal with systemic risk assessment issues on an ongoing basis.
Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Steve. I applaud everything that I've heard this morning, and although keeping in mind that, of course, I must disclaim speaking for anyone else at the Commission, hopefully I speak for myself, I think it's also important, and I think what you've heard coming here today, is to think about in setting up a fraud center, and I agree with Brandon, it really needs to go beyond fraud, and not involve labeling yourself as having committed fraud, which perhaps is even more important, that you need to set out at the first instance the kinds of things you may come up with and to cooperate with other people. And it strikes me, we've heard a lot this morning about a variety of different levels. At base, what we really want to accomplish is what one might call the impossible dream, which is to change ethics and culture and behavior so that everyone does the right thing. And we need to strive for that, even though we know we can't get there. And you need to think about coming out with solutions that involve incentives for good behavior, prophylactics and sanctions for bad behavior, and a combination of rules and principles, not to use what have become really trite terms, and think about the kinds of solutions, and also, given your focus on auditors, also working with other people who can focus on other people who are involved in the chain in terms of coming up with recommendations. And I know I look forward to working with you on it, and I'm sure my colleagues at the Commission do that as well.
Well, thank you very much. That's a terrific closing to the first panel, a very helpful summary, and Commissioner Walter, we certainly appreciate that endorsement and support for the Center. Why don't we take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 10 after 11. All right, I'd like to ask Commissioner Chairman Gelzer to start the next forum on foreign inspections. So, Dan, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'll just be brief and set in a little bit of the background. I think I've said publicly on other occasions that I regard one of the most serious and challenging problems that the PCAOB currently faces as our inability to make comprehensive and fully effective our foreign inspection program. We have approximately 930 accounting firms registered with us outside of the United States. They're located in 87 different jurisdictions. So we have, in that sense, worldwide responsibilities. Not all of those 930 firms are required to be inspected because many of them are not actually issuing audit reports that are filed with the SEC and therefore don't come within the scope of our existing inspection program, but at least several hundred of them are required to be periodically inspected. We do have an active foreign inspection program, and I don't want to leave the impression that we're not performing inspections outside the United States. In the 6 years or so that our inspection program has been operating, we've conducted about 200 inspections of non-U.S.-based firms in 33 different jurisdictions. Many of those inspections were conducted jointly with the home country audit oversight body, and as a general matter, when there is an inspection program operating in a country, we usually would try to conduct our inspections jointly with the home country authority. This year, in 2010, we are scheduled, required under our inspection frequency rules, to conduct an additional 91 inspections in 26 different countries. So, what's the problem? There are major obstacles to us being able to conduct the inspections that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act expects and requires us to conduct. Currently, we are unable to conduct inspections in any of the countries in the European Union, in China or in Switzerland. As to China, we are conducting inspections in Hong Kong, although there are some issues about work paper access in some cases there. I don't have complete market cap figures as to how that affects our inability to perform these inspections affects U.S. investors, but I think it's safe to say that it has a very important and profound effect on them. The market cap, the U.S. market cap of foreign private issuers in the places that we're unable to inspect is certainly in the hundreds of billions of dollars, but probably at least a trillion based on the numbers we have. You can add to that, that would just be the range of market cap for foreign private issuers where their auditor is located outside the United States. Obviously, in many cases, even though the signing auditor is in the United States, a substantial amount of the audit work is performed by a non-U.S. Audit firm. I think in the, for example, in the Lehman audit, the last Lehman audit that was performed, seems to have been in the news somewhat lately, almost half the assets were located outside the United States, and almost half the audit work was therefore performed by firms outside the United States. We certainly aren't taking this problem calmly, and we're trying to proceed on a number of different fronts to solve it. Perhaps the most obvious is negotiating with the audit oversight authorities in these places where we're not currently permitted to enter to try and resolve the issues of sovereignty or privacy of information or whatever the objection might be. We believe that the enactment of the financial services legislation that's currently pending in Congress would be an important step for us because that contains a provision that would let us share inspection information with foreign oversight, audit oversight bodies on the same terms that we can share information domestically. At least in some cases, our inability to engage in that kind of sharing is one of the objections that's been raised to our ability to come into the EU particularly and perform inspections. We're also, I think, mindful of the fact that investors do need to have information about our inability to conduct inspections in some cases. We now have information on our website about firms that we've been unable to inspect despite the fact that the inspection cycle has passed for them. Those are generally, I guess, without exception, foreign firms. And we're thinking about whether that disclosure should be expanded, perhaps to include the clients of those firms. There are other tools in our regulatory kit which we might be able to use. For example, additional requirements for U.S. auditors, signing auditors who rely on the work of foreign firms that we're not able to inspect, whether they should have to make some disclosure, have additional requirements with respect to themselves having possession of foreign work papers, other things in that range. And, of course, ultimately we also have enforcement tools that could be brought to bear against foreign firms that we're unable to inspect, although that using those tools would raise its own set of policy issues. So that's probably longer than you intended, Steve, but it might kick off to this discussion. I'd certainly be interested to hear this group's views.
Thanks, Tim and Gelser. You hit on some of the issues that we're going to hit on. This is a topic that we were assigned by Steve and Joanne and worked collaboratively. I'm going to make the presentation, but worked collaboratively on these slides with Barbara Roper from the Consumer Federation of America and Ann Yerger from the Council of Institutional Investors. And again, for the benefit of the webcast, I'm Joe Costello. You have the slides in front of you. Quickly, as you look at the slides, what we're going to talk about is just some very quick background information on the Act, current state of the inspections, challenges, number and size of foreign registrants, relative size of international subs. We looked a little bit at PCAOB inspection resources and rigor, lack of access by the PCAOB inspectors to certain foreign countries, the other independent audit regulators. As Steve requested, we do make some recommendations for the board's consideration and then to maybe jumpstart conversation, some questions for the group, but we could easily deviate from those questions. So this is the inspection mandate per the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Again, you have it on the slide, so I won't read this to you. You have it in front of you. and the intent of the inspections to evaluate the sufficiency of the firm's quality control system and the manner of documentation and communication of that system by the firm. The scope covers any registered public accounting firm that audits a company traded on a U.S. exchange, regardless of domicile. So I think one thing that's important to understand is the United States Congress would have been aware of some of these territorial claims that have been asserted at the time they passed the law, and the United States Congress chose to indicate that all firms registered with the board, regardless of domicile, should be inspected. There are approximately 2,500 firms registered with the board, including about 40 firms from 86 foreign countries outside the U.S. Frequency annually for registered public accounting firms that regularly audit more than 100 issuers. There's 10, all in the United States, at least once every 3 years for other registered public accounting firms that have issued an audit report on an issuer during the preceding year, at least one audit report. Our numbers suggest that there's approximately 450 firms in the U.S. and 200 firms outside the U.S. that would be subject to inspection requirements, so about 650, and then the 10 that are the very large firms, 660. No exemptions. All non-U.S. firms must register with the PCAOB, and the intent of this is it ensures compliance with the PCAOB's auditing and professional standards, inspections, and disciplinary regimes. There had been some discussion by the board of a full reliance approach on foreign regulators. At the moment, it looks like the board's leaning against that approach based on PCAOB release 2004-05. PCAOB retains overall authority over inspections, investigation, and enforcements. They did make a proposal for full reliance in 2007. No actions taken, going on 3 years, so my gut says, at least right now, that's probably cool. High cooperation. PCAOB cooperates as much as possible with counterparts around the globe. PCAOB Rule 4012 deals with foreign inspections and may rely on an independent audit oversight entities located in home countries of registered non-U.S. firms, and to the extent that the board relies on these other independent audit regulators, here are the characteristics that the board considers. Challenges, as Chairman Gelser said, there's a number of challenges posed by foreign inspections. Not all registered non-U.S. firms have been inspected. As of the end of 2009, 70 foreign firms in 25 foreign countries had not been inspected, even though more than 4 years had passed since the end of the year in which the firm first issued an audit report while registered with the PCAOB. So we're talking, if you kind of do the math there, right, guys and gals, that's 5 years or more. PCAOB difficulties inspecting some registered non-U.S. firms, access denied to PCAOB based on legal conflicts with home country laws or objections based on national sovereignty. Chairman Gelser has indicated some of the actions the board has already taken. Disclose names of firms not yet inspected. Disclose names of jurisdictions that deny access. There's been a deferral in getting all this done for 2012. Proposed legislation that the chairman alluded to that may end up as part of the financial regulatory bill. We also need to understand that the largest auditing firms are composed of global networks of affiliates. Affiliates are separate legal entities. I question whether most U.S. investors understand that. Independent and autonomous. Affiliates of a U.S. accounting firm may be subject to quality assurance, risk management, overall business reviews, codes of ethics and professional conduct, and practice rules. So they do attempt to integrate on some of these dimensions, but in terms of legal structure, they typically are separate. Audits of global clients, as Dan said, are handled by affiliated firms. When I was in public accounting, we had a few multinationals, and we never were getting on planes jetting around the globe. We used the foreign affiliates of our firm to do that work. Foreign registrants audited by non-U.S. auditors are significant to the capital markets, the U.S. capital markets. We used audit analytics, and a little over 10% of all companies on audit analytics, which is most of the SEC universe, it's around 9,000. Public companies, over 10% are foreign registrants. Some market cap numbers European Union and Norway over $500 billion, Switzerland over $75 billion, China and Hong Kong over $75 billion. It's hard to get exact numbers on this, as Chairman Gelser indicated, but these are big numbers, no matter how you slice it. And keep in mind that these foreign registrants are not being audited by the big four firms that we all know and love here in the United States. So I'm handing out another piece of paper for you that I think you'll find quite interesting. And this piece of paper, we took the 50 largest foreign registrants. Okay, so this is the 50 foreign registrants. And we looked to see who signed the opinion. Seems interesting, right? Six different flavors of Deloitte. 10 different flavors of Ernst. 9 different flavors of KPMG, and 10 different flavors of PwC. So I have some questions just to spur your intellectual curiosity this morning. Do U.S. investors even realize that some of these entities are not the U.S. firm? Okay? So let's look at PricewaterhouseCoopers. You remember tick marks from public accounting? Remember that, Lynn? A and B. PricewaterhouseCoopers, in brackets, that's me. That's not on the signature. Okay, so it says PricewaterhouseCoopers in brackets Hong Kong. That's not, it's on the signature to the extent that they put the city and state or the country and so forth. But they don't call it PricewaterhouseCoopers Hong Kong. They call it PricewaterhouseCoopers. Now, you think if a U.S. investor saw that, what would they think? Okay? Where it is obvious that the firm is not a U.S. firm, I love KPMG's affiliate in Germany, I can't even write the thing, would U.S. investors think this is a wholly owned sub of a U.S. firm? I think some of them would. Do U.S. investors realize that in the case of litigation, that each of these firms are generally legally separate entities? And there are 35 separate affiliated Big Four firms on this list in 15 countries. Approximately 15 countries. Do investors expect a Big Four firm to deliver uniform audit quality given a U.S. listing and compliance with PCAOB standards? I would think the answer to that is yes. And is that happening? That's obviously an empirical question, and obviously why foreign inspections are so important. In addition to what we did with foreign registrants, as Chairman Gelser indicated, the thing that worries me as much as the foreign registrants is U.S. multinationals. That's where so much of our market cap is, and a huge amount of the work is being done overseas by foreign affiliate firms. So what we did is we pulled the geographic area disclosures, and I need to thank Matt Hoag and Derek Hobby, who are students at the University of Tennessee, who actually did a lot of this. This was a significant amount of data pulling in a short period of time. But advantages of being at a university. Geographic area disclosures, the old FAS 131, for the Fortune 100. And what we did is we looked at revenues, foreign revenues to total revenues, and foreign assets to total assets. And we also looked at the number of subsidiaries, both domestic subsidiaries and U.S. subsidiaries. So if you use medians, you see that there's about 113 subsidiaries for these companies, 28 of which are foreign. So that's what? More than 25% of the subsidiaries of the Fortune 100 are outside the United States. If you compare international revenues, if you do it based on companies that include all companies, include all companies, including those with no international revenue, mean revenue to total revenue is 24%, mean assets to total assets are 16%. If you exclude companies with no international revenue, some companies that are just purely U.S. domestic, mean revenue from foreign operations to total revenue is 36%, mean assets to total assets are 30%. So however you slice it, it's a very significant chunk of U.S. multinational financial statements. We also looked, tried to compare the PCAOB inspection process here in the United States to the PCAOB inspection process of foreign affiliates. This was difficult to do with any degree of reliability using the public portions of inspection reports. So we kind of cheated. We used the PCAOB's Office of Internal Oversight and Performance Assurance report that was issued on December 4th, 2009, and this is a public document. It's been submitted to the chairman of the SEC with Chairman Gelser's cover letter, so there's nothing that the board and the SEC don't know here. But issues related to rigor of some international inspections, particularly related to documentation, scope, consideration of risk and reliance on foreign regulators, until recently is a lack of a system of accountability. So even in, not to be unkind, but even where the board is getting in, there are still issues. Even where they're able to get in and do inspections, it's not going probably as smoothly as they would like. And then there's the issue of lack of access by PCAOB inspectors to certain foreign countries. And among these countries, as again as the chairman indicated, China, third in the world in gross domestic product, Germany, fourth in the world in gross domestic product, France, fifth in the world in gross domestic product, the United Kingdom, sixth in the world in gross domestic product. So you're covered here in the U.S. You're okay if you're in Boston or L.A. or Atlanta, and you're okay if you're in Japan, because they're second in GDP. Other than that, you got an issue. Other than that, you got an issue. Okay, then we looked at independent audit regulators and their inspection regimes. So we focused on examining the independent audit regulator in the 10 largest countries based on gross domestic product. Website content and reporting was sporadic and inconsistent across various countries. So this is rough. This is rough. This was not any degree of uniformity here. But most usable reports in our judgment were from the U.S., Japan, U.K., Italy, and Canada. Reports were not available in English for France and Germany, and we were not, and we were unable to locate reports for China, Brazil, and Spain. It appeared that the board of the independent audit regulator was independent in the U.S., Japan, Germany, U.K., and Canada. The board does not appear to be independent in Italy and Brazil, and we could not determine if the board was independent in China, France, and Spain. Also, in Japan and Canada, there aren't separate inspection reports on the big four firms, but rather they issue a combined report. We also looked at kind of resources available. So for the 2008 fiscal year, the PCAOB's operating expenses were approximately $134 million, $9 million in Canada, $5 million in the U.K. PCAOB had 258 inspection employees. Japan had 39, Canada had 24, and the U.K. had 18. In 2008, the PCAOB completed 255 inspections. Canada completed 42. The United Kingdom completed 19. Japan completed 120, but it appeared to us it was done by what I'll call the Japanese analog of the AICPA. So since the United States Congress has specifically rejected that approach, I put that down kind of indented, not at the same level of not comparable to the others. Okay, so in addition, reasoning by analogy, let's compare U.S. securities regulator. This is for you, Commissioner Walter. With international securities regulators. So from 1987 to 1997, there were 300 enforcement actions by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Not 300 unique companies. There were many more enforcement actions. So not uncommon for there to be two or three or four enforcement actions coming out of one case, right? The company and the management of the company and maybe the auditor. 300 unique, what I'll call, instances of fraud. In the study that will be released in a couple of weeks, there's 350. So fraud's not going away. It's becoming slightly more prevalent. It's lasting a little longer. And as you'll see when the study comes out, the size of the fraud is significantly larger. So, and even if we truncate at the 95th percentile in and take Enron and WorldCom out, it's still significantly larger. There's a study in Canada by Magnon et al. In 2010, 15 enforcement actions over the 11-year period from 1995 to 2005 in Canada. Other than the United Kingdom, probably the country closest to us in terms of culture and background and so forth. So being a good academic, I have a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer, right? That's what a good rhetorical question is for the group. Given the difference in the apparent rigor of the enforcement program between the U.S. securities regulator and at least one foreign counterpart, why should we expect the rigor of inspections between the U.S. independent audit regulator and foreign independent audit regulators to be any different? Not saying it can't be, but that somebody would have to come up with a good reason as to why it would be. So recommendations for the PCAOB per Steve's request. Redouble efforts to get access to these foreign accounting firms through political and diplomatic negotiations. In our view, me and Barbara and Ann, the board should not take any of its options off the table at this point. Deregistering foreign accounting firms where inspections cannot be conducted. We're not suggesting the board go there first by any stretch of the imagination, but in any negotiation, to take your strongest weapon off the table before the negotiation starts strikes us as ill-advised. In the interim, the board should require disclosure of names of foreign registered accounting firms that have not been inspected. This is already being done, Chairman Gelser indicated. Names of foreign registrants in countries where inspections have not occurred. Name the companies, as Dan suggested. They're not there yet, but they've talked about that. Names of U.S. multinationals if material foreign subsidiaries have been audited by foreign accounting firms that have not been inspected, and the percentages of consolidated revenues, income, and assets of foreign subs audited by foreign accounting firms that have not been inspected. So if Gus is sitting up there in Valley Forge and he says, I've got this audit report, and it says 60% of consolidated revenues, income, and assets have been audited by foreign affiliates in countries that maybe he's concerned about transparency and the rule of law and so forth, and there's no inspection going on of the audit work in that country, then as the investor, he has a choice to make. He's fully informed. He doesn't have lack of information. He may say, I don't care. I don't care. I'm still going to own that stock. Or he may say, no. Forewarned is forearmed. I don't want to own the stock. In addition, for foreign subs of U.S. multinationals audited by foreign affiliates of a U.S. firm, the board should require the U.S. accounting firm to conduct detailed internal inspection of its foreign affiliates. I think this is what the chairman was getting at. The board could put in place additional requirements on the U.S. firm that's relying on the work of the foreign affiliate. Okay? And so the foreign government may block the board. You use the U.S. firm as your proxy. Review these internal inspections and inspect its division of enforcement. I want to make sure that Claudius doesn't get bored. To hold U.S. accounting firms responsible for the failures of their foreign affiliates when auditing material foreign subsidiaries of U.S. multinationals. And then we have questions, but we obviously will talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. So hopefully I tried to do that quickly because I wanted to make sure there's plenty of time for people to talk. So,
could I just ask you one quick question? On your recommendations, you don't seem to have linked the ability to do inspections to convergence issues. And do you see a connection between those two?
The ability to do inspections to convergence of accounting standards or auditing standards?
Accounting standards.
Or
do you view that as two independent conversations, parallel tracks that shouldn't be connected?
If there's a Venn diagram, there's overlap. We might have different opinions as to how much overlap there is, but there's certainly overlap. As you rightly point out now, certainly on foreign registrants, in all likelihood, they're filing with the SEC using IFRS as issued by the IASB. Now, that won't be the case for foreign subs of U.S. multinationals. They'll still be using U.S. GAAP. So for that part of it, no issue, right? But for foreign registrants, yeah, there's obviously an issue that the board is going to need the capacity in an inspection sense to not only evaluate auditing, which is still the same, PCAOB standards are still the same, but be able to evaluate the application of IFRS effectively for these foreign registrants. Because, yeah, you're right. That's a fair point. And that's a capability they need to have in place to be able to do that effectively. Yeah.
I'm surprised, Joe, that you're not to move on from accounting standards to talk about international auditing standards, that there's no recommendation that relates to that and to moving forward with people around the globe
through IFER and otherwise towards having auditing standards converge, because even if you solve the inspections problem, if you've got a variety of qualities of auditing standards, the problem is still in some ways going to persist. So yeah. I would think that ought to be on the table as well.
It is on the agenda for today, Commissioner Walter. It wasn't specifically our charge, but I'll say a couple of things about it. At least my understanding that if you are a foreign registrant and you're filing with the SEC, regardless of the country you're in, you can use IFRS right now, but you still have to do the audit using PCAOB auditing standards. And so you might be in Brazil and you might be using ISAs, and my understanding is most of the big four, their underlying platform, their audit methodology platform is based on the ISAs, the International Standards of Auditing. But then for companies that file with the SEC, they lay on top of that any incremental PCAOB requirements. Now, a discussion of whether or not the PCAOB should move in the direction of adopting the ISAs broadly, I think we'll have that discussion later, and so I don't want to take it too far afield. I did look at the IAASB, and I'm sure you've looked at it as well. And when you look at that and you look at the current composition of the IAASB, and it's 18 people, and you count the people who are currently, I'm not talking about past, because Marty's past and he has enough inspections here for the PCAOB, who are currently working in public accounting, it's about 50%. And it's heavily represented by the Big Four, which, again, was the model we had at the Auditing Standards Board. That was the model that, you know, I've had since I was in my 20s, that Charlie had when he practiced accounting, that Dan had for the few years he was in accounting. And the United States Congress specifically rejected that approach. Okay, now, they gave the board the option of delegating standard setting. The board has chosen not to do that. And
I guess the point I'm making is a little bit different than that, not so much necessarily a movement towards international auditing standards, but rather the notion that if you look at the Big Four and you say their platform is based on one set of standards with others as an add-on, that's not necessarily the healthiest underlying condition. I mean, long-term, if the issues that underlie this issue are going to be solved, you want one very robust set of auditing standards to be applied across the board, and that I think is particularly troublesome when you sort of have things as an add-on, because it's not what you do daily, and remembering that I have to do extra things for this guy but not for that guy is not a good thing.
Yeah, no, you're right, that's a good point. I think the discussion is how do you get to one set of global auditing standards the same as one set of global accounting standards that are uniformly high quality in the investor's best interest and promulgated by bodies that are independent of the profession itself. And right now, the IAASB, at least in my view, is not quite there. But I think, Steve, that's on the agenda for later today, isn't it?
I think it's on the agenda for later today. I don't know whether Marty Baumann wants to take a brief moment to discuss, you know, our standard-setting process, and it will be brief, but the fact of the matter is Sarbanes-Oxley, the spirit, the vision of the underlying bill was that the PCAOB be the gold standard in terms of setting standards. And for this particular group, I think it's important to know that first and foremost, in terms of our standard setting, or if not first and foremost, certainly a very, very high priority, is how do they improve from an investor protection standpoint the standards that are already out there. And so we're doing a very, very careful analysis of the interim standards, the international standards, in terms of setting our own standards. But, Marty, do you want to take a second and just... If he's here.
I anticipated you and I moved right
ahead. All right. I didn't see it. Thank you.
Well, I think Joe has kind of alluded to some of the points that are important in this regard, and Steve, you did also, that Congress in Sarbanes-Oxley intended for standard setting to change, intended for a lot of things to change in the oversight of auditing. And right now, standard setting is in the hands of an independent regulator, as opposed to standard setting largely dominated by the profession, as Joe Carcello just pointed out. So we are writing and updating and writing a lot of new standards. We look to see what the international and other standard setters have done, but we take a thorough and comprehensive look, and we add whatever requirements we think are appropriate to have the what we think are the highest quality auditing standards that are that can be inspected against and can be appropriately enforced, and therefore can result in the highest degree of audit quality. So we have an ambitious standard-setting agenda and program that we think will achieve those goals.
And Barbara, why don't we turn to you, and then Damon, and thank you for, first of all, testifying for the public service, whatever you said. Thank you for getting out of that hearing as quickly as you could and joining us on this panel. We did miss you on the first panel, but we welcome you here. So, Barbara, why don't we start with you, and then Damon.
You know me well enough, Steve, to know you shouldn't issue those kind of blanket thank yous when I get in front of a microphone. But, I mean, I just, first of all, Joe did us his service of giving us credit on his presentation for contributing, and I think Ann did. I did essentially nothing. There may be one sentence in this which I contributed, which is not an effort on my part to walk away from it, but I think Joe did a terrific job, and he put a lot of work into it, and I think it shows. On this issue of what was raised is, you know, how does this issue relate to IFRS and audit standard convergence? I feel very strongly that it does not relate to them at all. There is a mandate in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that the PCAOB inspect foreign firms. It was an effort was made in committee to strip that out. In the conference committee, both Senator Graham and Representative Oxley attempted to strip that out in conference committee. It was rejected, and it was rejected in face of all of the arguments that had been brought to bear by another number of foreign entities. So Congress thought about this long and hard. They made this decision, and they made it despite considerable opposition. So I think it has to be taken very seriously that they view this as an absolutely essential component of effective PCAOB operations. On the questions of the international audit standards, those of us who lobbied on this legislation fought very hard to ensure that this body would have the authority to set the audit standards, and that we would change a system in which audit standard setting was dominated by the industry, because we felt that it had given us standards that were written primarily to protect, or with an excessive eye toward protecting the auditors from liability rather than resulting in effective audits. And given the current state of affairs in the international audit standard setting process, to move too precipitously toward some sort of international convergence with standards would simply put us right back to the system, as Joe suggested, that Congress specifically rejected when it offered this model. We would be back to having considerable and excessive, in my view, input from the auditors in the setting of those standards, and that would not, I think, benefit the standards themselves. Which doesn't mean there shouldn't be some sort of general discussion of trying to move in the same direction and reach agreement when it's possible, but it can't become an end in itself. Beyond that, I think there's something of a myth about the benefits of this, even in a theoretical sense, which is the idea that uniform standards would produce uniform audits. We know, for example, with IFRS, that uniform accounting standards don't produce uniform accounting. There is at least some sort of theoretical logic to having one language that everybody speaks in terms of accounting standards. I just don't see the same logic on audit standards, and I think that if you don't solve this basic problem first of getting the inspections and the enforcement and everything working, that simply moving towards comparable standards won't do anything to get us closer, anything significant to get us closer to comparable audits. It's really on this end of getting the inspections system functioning that we need to bring us all closer together to performing the highest quality audits.
And Damon, identify yourself for the public.
I'm Damon Silvers. I'm the policy director of the AFL-CIO. First, let me say I apologize for not being here earlier this morning. As you noted, the Senate Judiciary Committee requested that Barbara and I be there to talk about some related issues to this meeting. I wanted to impose upon you for a moment on the subject of the last panel, and just to say that, you know, I think that the notion of a fraud center is extremely important, that it needs to be seen in a critical sense as a way of, as a filter for moving the considerable amount of non-public information that the PCAOB has about the practices of the auditing profession in relationship to fraud detection and prevention, making it available to current practitioners. It's a device for essentially solving an information problem inherent in the confidentiality issues associated with what the board does, and also a way of systematizing learning in a sort of forensic, you know, National Transportation Safety Board-like way when we have major frauds that occur. And I would note that I understand that Commissioner Walters was supportive of that, of the general concept in the discussion, and I wanted to commend her for that. Now, to come to this matter, I've been involved in my other capacity for the PCAOB at the Standing Advisor Group in a variety of conversations about the issue of foreign inspections and the obstacles that the PCAOB faces in relation to foreign inspections. I would echo what Barbara Roper said about the current state of affairs in relation to international convergence in audit standards. It was very clear to me that at the time when this idea was being broached in the waning days of the Bush administration, that it was part of a comprehensive push to essentially, in labor movement terms, to whipsaw investor protections internationally, to force a further weakening of U.S. investor protections across a wide range of the regulatory system by trying to push us to the lowest common denominator of what existed in other markets. As it turned out, our investor protections and financial market regulatory system was woefully underpowered even as it was then, let alone weakened further. This is not to say, and here I may disagree with Barbara on a rare occasion, that is not to say that the idea of having strong global auditing standards would not be a good idea if we could get such a thing. But as long as we have a process that would inevitably be dominated by the firms themselves, given the composition of the PCAOB's counterparts, I don't see how we get there. That's also my view about financial accounting standards. That there's nothing per se wrong with common financial accounting standards as a concept. The question is how do you get there with some integrity? The board, I'm very sympathetic with the board's problem of what to do about this, about numbers 2 through 6 in the global economy being off limits. One suggestion I have, in addition to the items that are on the list that Joe prepared, is that this is something where the commission may have a very strong role to play. The basic political dynamic that I see is that we have foreign governments fronting for foreign audit firms, and really no price is being paid by foreign issuers for this arrangement. A giant stamp in 18-point type on the front cover of a 20F or a 10K that says, you know, material portions of this financial statement have been audited by audit firms have not been inspected by the PCAOB or anyone working in concert with PCAOB and cannot be relied upon. I think that would motivate some folks. And whether or not you actually do 18-point type, that's not really the commission's style, but some kind of coordinated activity around disclosure between the board and the commission, addressed not just at audit firms but at issuers, might do wonders in this area to alter the general set of motivations and politics in economies 2 through 6.
Am I missing something here? A company that's registered with the SEC has to have a required.
And then, Judge, identify yourself for the audience.
Stan Sporkin. A company that's registered with the SEC or trading in the SEC has to have an auditor. That auditor has to be a member of the PCAOB, and that auditor, I assume, as a requirement of becoming a member, has to agree that it will be inspected. Am I missing something in that?
No.
Huh? Then what is it that's, I mean, what is it if they do not agree, then you take their license away, and then the company can't be, has to get a new auditor. Is there something I've missed here? I'm a simple person, but I don't know what is it that I'm missing.
You haven't missed anything, and you put in the board members in a tough position, but you haven't missed anything, and they have the authority to do that.
Right.
If they did that, let's just be practical.
Yeah.
If they did that without the support of Chairman Shapiro, there'd be a major problem. And if they did that, probably even without the support of the Treasury and the White House, they'd have a problem. There'd be major international repercussions.
Can I tell you something? And again, I hate to say when I was at the SEC, but when I was at the SEC, we had the five biggest banks in Mexico that were trading here in the United States, and the securities were not registered. By a stroke of the pen, we put them on a foreign restricted list, which said you cannot trade these securities in the United States, okay? And you will not believe, yeah, I had the State Department and everybody else banging on my door, but I will tell you this, they registered within 2 or 3 days. And I must tell you, you can't back down. This is not anything different than a lot of other issues that we've had over the years. You don't back down. In foreign corrupt practices, we said we're going to destroy the world or destroy our companies because they can't compete in the world. We didn't back down. And I don't understand why is it you have to back down? You say that's your rule. You either comply or you don't comply. With respect to the umbrella companies, the umbrella, and as I understand it, the affiliated companies are registered with the PCAOB. Am I right on some of them? I know one of my clients is registered, and they consider it very important. So, we're trying to accommodate something that we don't know. And I would assume with this administration, they'd be pretty firm. But look, that's the way I used to do things, but maybe they're done differently now.
There's an aspect of this that hasn't been mentioned, which is this is not a fight between foreign companies and the PCAOB, or between foreign auditors and the PCAOB. There are countervailing laws in countries. This is a conflict between foreign law and U.S. law, and that dynamic really has to be taken into account. That hasn't been mentioned here.
Yeah, I understand that. Let's assume you're right. But foreign law understands that if you go into their country, you got to comply with their law. And if they come into our country, they got to comply with our law. I mean, that's a very simple thing. Right.
Stanley, in all fairness, they view this as us coming into their country and refusing to comply with their law. So it all depends. The dynamic is in the eye of the beholder, and I'm not meaning to sound like an apologist for this, but it's a complicated issue, and it's one that has strong international ramifications and needs to be approached with delicacy. We want to get there. We don't want to create an international incident.
I don't want to debate this, but I look at things differently. I think we create our own problems a lot of times by assuming certain things. But either we do have it that we got to follow our rules, or we don't. And I think it's that simple. I don't understand how we make exceptions. Why do we make simple issues complex? Test these countries, see what happens. And if you have to, some of these securities won't trade here. That's very simple. But it's a question of might. Well, I assume we're the greatest country in the world. Why don't we show it?
Well, Tony, why don't we go to you and then we'll go around.
First, I thank Joe and his team for putting this together. It was really very informative. Just a couple of quick comments. I think Barbara said it. Uniform standards don't produce uniform accounting. I think there is this widely held belief that the IFRS is going to do all kinds of good things. Unfortunately, the way I see it, from what I have found, there are 23 different versions of the IFRS floating around. There are companies that used to say, they don't say it anymore, that used to say, these financial statements are prepared in accordance with IFRS, except where home country GAAP is better. They had just neglected to tell us where it was better. That's one thing. The other thing is that we look around today and we find, for example, in Spain, there's dynamic provisioning for banks. That's not what the IFRS allows. I understand that it's not in any one of those 23 versions either. So how come Spain's banks are allowed to do this? Now, we've talked about this, the CFA Institute, we've talked about this with the SEC, and there are things that they're doing that will help over time. The other thing is that I definitely agree that the clients ought to be disclosed. We ought to be, the investors need to know where a significant portion of the financial statements can't be relied upon. The other thing is that I applaud, as I said earlier, the work that you've done in showing with respect using FAS 131 on segment reporting. Unfortunately, knowledge of knowing that it's 24% of the assets and X percent of the revenues does not tell me what percentage of the liabilities and the risks. It does not tell me how many off-balance sheet obligations there are. Right, and they don't. No, I know. What I'm saying is that I agree. Unfortunately, we're not asking them to disclose it. And I also understand that we have these things about off-balance sheet obligations. Now, the problem I have with that is the definition of an off-balance sheet obligation, which I worked on several years ago, is very simply this. It's something that has an economic consequence but does not get an accounting and regulatory recognition. The problem I have with that is that the only way you can actually undertake an off-balance sheet obligation is by using resources provided by investors. You can't do it any other way. Now, if you can't get an off-balance sheet obligation without using my money, I think you ought to tell me how you're using it. I don't care whether it doesn't meet an accounting standard. So in that sense, fundamentally, we've got something very, very seriously missing over here. And the belief in foreign countries about some of these things, I remember a few years ago going with a team that was put together by USAID to two foreign countries which were starting stock exchanges there. One of them told me I was supposed to help with the accounting end of things. And one of them said, well, our accounting standards are similar to IFRS. So I said, why don't you send me a summary of your standards? After 6 months, I finally received it, and it said the following. Our accounting standards are similar to IFRS, with the exception of the following. We don't have a standard for consolidation, acquisition accounting, foreign currency translation. And I said, why do I need to read anything? How are they similar? If you can actually assume that your standards are similar without having 80% of the accounting standards that one would think, what's the auditing going to do for me?
Thank you, Steve. Robert Tarola. In our system, the audit committee is responsible for making sure that there's a quality audit done for the company they oversee. I sit on the audit committee of a global enterprise, and we look to the audit team that comes into our meetings every quarter and insist that they answer our questions about the quality of the auditing around the world. That's our job as an audit committee member. It would help, I think, if you insisted that in their standard communications that they talk about that issue as opposed to us having to drag it out of them. But beyond that, I hope you can get the access that would give us all a little more satisfaction that these groups are being inspected. But I don't think that relieves the audit committee of its responsibility.
Bob, you raised a question in terms of, or Joe, I'm sorry, you raised a question at the end of your sheet. Do investors expect a Big Four firm to deliver uniform audit quality given a U.S. listing in compliance with PCAOB standards? How would you respond to that question? I mean, how would the investor group respond to that? And then
well,
what do you think ought to be done? What do you think ought to be done in that area?
I'm just an individual investor and not a very wealthy one at that. But I would expect that the answer to that would be affirmative. But why don't you ask people who really manage money? You know, Gus and Norman and others, Tony. You know, I mean, these guys manage money. I mean, they're better to answer that question than me.
Gus, would you care to take a crack at that?
Yeah, well, certainly the answer would be affirmative. Trying to think. If I could pass for a minute, I'll gather my thoughts. And,
sorry.
Yeah.
Gus, you're off the hook. Kalpas. Although I'm sort of referring back to World Bank days here where, like you, Tony, going to countries where you would have companies floating under one of the big four, then big six names as though it meant something. And that's the problem. It's snake oil. And the simple solution is to look at how do we deal with an abuse of a branding franchise. And I know we're going to talk about governance issues after lunch. But that to me is the problem. If you were to sort of have, you know, here's PwC's subpar operation in a market which is not properly regulated without proper standards, and guess what? Without even qualified professional staff. Because in some markets there's simply an absence of qualified people. Never mind having the rules on the paper. World Bank can go in and write all the rules you like. If you don't have qualified people who can serve that function, it doesn't mean a thing. So I think the real problem, we're trying to find ways to deal with what, you know, Jules Maus saw this as the McDonald's problem. Now if you go to buy a McDonald's in one of, you know, 100 different countries around the world, you expect your hamburgers to be made of beef to a certain standard of cleanliness, hygiene, and lack of salmonella, and who knows what else. And that is what McDonald's does, is make sure the McDonald's franchise is that hamburger is going to taste the same in Mumbai, London, Milwaukee, anywhere you buy it. And what the audit firms have done is trade on the idea of a global franchise without delivering the content or the quality or the food safety that even McDonald's aspires to. So I think we probably need to turn back to that issue, and I think it's back to old-fashioned ideas, caveat emptor, 18 points, 36 points, but making clear that you do not have the comfort of a big four quality standard that you would expect, for example, from the US market. That seems to me disclosure would get us a long way down the road on this. Why? Because then the market, people like us, we would start to price that information differently, and issuers would begin to understand the real advantage of getting quality audits, and actually that would then tie into, I think, not a sort of doomed effort for international standards. I don't see us getting there anywhere while we're all living. But actually, what we need to do is to find ways to get competitive pressures leading us in the direction of higher standards. And I think that could be more fruitful.
I just wanted to follow on what Anne said. I think specifically what would happen if there were clear disclosures about this. It's not just that there'd be pricing effects. I think pricing might be kind of challenging. I don't know how traders would work with that information. But I do think there would be instantaneous governance effects. I believe that, you know, the institutional investor community prior to Sarbanes-Oxley was extremely active around issues of independent auditors, independent audit committees, and the like. And essentially, after Sarbanes-Oxley, said, well, this is now resolved. We don't need to take up these issues. I think there would be an instantaneous focus on these disclosures, both with foreign private issuers, but I think more consequentially, as long as the standard was a material portion of the financial statements for their disclosure, I think you would immediately see a focus on U.S. U.S. issuers, and there would, and I think you, the whole climate here, I think, would change very rapidly in that environment.
This is Gus Sauter. I did have this conversation with our auditors, and as Joe pointed out, many of us assume that it's more than just a federation of auditors when you think of these multinational auditing firms. But in fact, they were telling me that, in fact, it truly is just a federation, and they have less impact to their with their international counterparts than they might desire. It might be an interesting tactic to. I think full disclosure would be very important. I think I think Joe brought it out to begin with that there are a lot of investors that really don't realize that you're not getting the same quality when you're getting opinions from outside of the United States. And it might be an interesting tactic to try to coerce firms to put more pressure on international standards or oversight committees. I guess it was Ann who said that in the end there is still caveat emptor, and I guess we proceed along those lines with just about everything we do. But I think it would be good to try to put more leverage to get standards the same abroad. And I know that our auditor would actually like to see that, but they feel a little bit unempowered to do that. So I think the pressure has to really come from the oversight committee to force that.
I'll be very brief. I'm in violent agreement with Ann and Damon and Gus. I think there is there is an issue of holding out. Obviously, the Big Four in particular, they market a brand and invest a lot of money in those brands, not only in terms of client acceptance or competing for engagements, but I do think that it is, and implicit in that is a message that you know, we are part of a global network or federation, but nonetheless, there is some minimum standard of quality that we adhere to and that we deliver. And I think only when you begin to ask the questions and peel back the layers of that onion, you realize that that may not necessarily be the case, which is why, again, I completely agree that improved disclosure in this area, I think, would be extremely important and valuable. Not only disclosure about the global structure and the legal affiliation among the members of the global enterprise within the firm, but disclosures, this may bleed into our afternoon panel, but disclosures about their all audit quality control procedures in the other jurisdictions, and disclosures about regulatory or compliance matters that their foreign affiliates have faced that would be relevant to a board member, and I'm joined by two members, one of whom has her placard up, who may have some views on that as well, but I think stringent disclosure requirements would be very, very important here.
This is Tony Sonley. I think that there's a lot of work to be done, and yet I would not want to understate the responsibility of the investors. I think it's up to us to evaluate this. If I'm going to make an investment on behalf of my clients, I need to know what the auditor has done, and I need to be completely and as careful as I can. I need to be aware of it. My co-author on my book on financial analysis, Jerry White, likes to say that if you accept a financial statement as it is written, if you accept an audit statement as it states, if you accept a rating agency's ratings without asking questions, then you're not a financial analyst, you're a journalist. And I think there's a distinction that investors need to be aware of. And we like to think of it that way.
This is Bonnie Hill. I serve on the board of a company that does business all over the world. And while I'm not currently on the audit committee, I was on the audit committee, and I will say that we get pretty extensive reports in the boardroom from the audit committee's deliberations. And our auditors do let us know, as well as our internal auditors and CFO, that they're using affiliates of their companies throughout the world. And what we do, and I think the board is very comfortable with, is that our CFO and our auditing firm go and work directly with those people throughout the country. and throughout the world, actually throughout the world. And what happens is that on occasion our chair of the audit committee also goes. So we know that we're dealing with a number of different standards. We discuss those, and we discuss how to rectify those to the standards that we require of our company. And I think it's very important that you just don't let it go. You know, you cannot assume that all the information you're getting is clear and is exactly to the standards that you would expect without overseeing it from inside the company. Otherwise, how can you expect investors to have the confidence in your company that you're overseeing it in the way that they would like to have it overseen? So I think it's critical that the company itself, and I agree, Tony, investors as well, but provide oversight and not leave it to chance.
Have the ability, the regulators have the ability to deal with something. You know the problem. A debacle occurs. You haven't dealt with it. You've got Madoff all over again. And I think you can't shoulder, neither the SEC nor your board can shoulder this thing when you have the ability to deal with it. And I think a debacle happens, and I don't know how you're going to defend it. If I'm advising you, as I do clients, once you have that ability to deal with it and you don't deal with it, it's a prescription to disaster. And there's no way to hide. You can't say it was a complex issue. You can't say it was this. You can't say it was that. You've got to deal with it. And that's what we've learned time and time again. You can't, there's no fig leaf anymore.
You're making our job so easy, Judge.
I guess summarize, and I've heard this a lot, is I don't think you can take responsibility away from the boardroom and the audit committee and management and their oversight responsibility of their accounting firm. So I think that's an important point that's been made by multiple people around. And I think on a multinational financial statement, you have one partner that's signing the overall opinion on those financial statements, and that partner ultimately is saying that the entire audit, not just the U.S. portion of the audit, is supporting that opinion and is able to sign that opinion based on the work at all the affiliates. And that exists, and therefore I would assume a couple of ways: full disclosure, inspection of that firm and requiring them to say how could they sign that opinion and not stand behind that is the same as quality as our audit standards if it's material to the financial statements. I don't understand how they can run and hide, and I don't understand why we can't it can't be full disclosure and in their inspections holding them 100% accountable for the opinion they've signed. And if it's a material aspect to the financial statements, they're signing off on that, not the foreign partner. But that doesn't make the problem go away. I just think you have disclosure and your inspection of the signing firm that you can hold accountable. And then if you have to deregister foreign ones, I guarantee if you came to me and said, my accounting firm, we have to take off your list and isn't eligible to do your audit anymore, we'd fire them in a heartbeat. I mean, you know, so you have the power to influence. So I don't want to repeat other things, but I think there are some mechanisms here that through full disclosure and current inspections, you get pretty far down that path. But that's just my thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to briefly indicate that we've got we're considering a standard on that subject?
Well, you've indicated. I think I'll pick that. You asked me to summarize, Steve. I think I'll pick that up in my summary at the end.
I just wanted to second what Judge Sporkin said. I in your own report from the IOPA, basically said, and I'm quoting there now, as currently situated, the International Inspection Program represents a significant risk to the board. I think you guys know that. I think you're in a difficult position. I think the SEC is in a difficult position, but I think the judge is right. If a U.S. multinational, if a Fortune 50 company
has a major fraud seated in an international sub that has not been inspected. And let's not lose sight of the fact that a big part of the WorldCom fraud was seated outside the United States, the same thing at the extent there's problems at Lehman, seated outside the United States. If there was a major fraud that affected U.S. investors in a Fortune 50 company in a foreign affiliate that had not been inspected, the board obviously is aware of this issue. The SEC is obviously aware of this issue. I think the judgment on both regulators would be severe and unforgiving.
Just very quickly, because I think I agree with almost everything that's... Oh, sorry, Ann Yerger with the council. I agree with everything that's been said. I just wanted to sort of follow up on Commissioner Walter, your comment about convergence of international auditing standards, and I wanted to give a recommendation to the board. And that is, I'm not an auditor, so this was a new area for me. I did a lot of research. I don't have graduate students. So digging around to sort of get your hands around this was actually quite daunting. So I believe very strongly in the need for issuer-based disclosures, and obviously disclosures to the audit committee. I would encourage the board to think about putting more information on its website about those five factors and how those apply to the non-U.S. Overseers. I don't really understand the Japanese overseer for the audit profession. I mean, it's just impossible to know. So to a certain extent, I think it would help the assessment of the issuer-based disclosures if you could understand what the oversight regimes are like outside of the U.S. And that information is extremely difficult to get your hands around. And I think that might actually help move us more in the area of convergence in this area, although I should tell you I'm more optimistic about high-quality accounting standard convergence before we're going to get to high-quality audit standard convergence.
I was once one of those grad students, so thank your students greatly. First of all, the inspection and standards I do see as two different topics, and I think you do need to get to these inspections. I do strongly support disclosure around which specific clients the audits aren't being inspected on. To Stanley's point on dealing with the foreign regulators, as some as you know, I negotiated the agreement that created the ISB. And those were very tough negotiations over some period of time. I personally don't see this issue any different in terms of what you would have to go through negotiation than what we did. And we got tremendous pushback by some people in different parts of the world, especially the European Commission, as people know. But I must say I am in agreement with Stanley that unless the Commission, Commissioner Walters, stands up and takes a strong stand here and gives strong support to the PCAOB, we are going to find ourselves in our capital markets getting watered down, and ultimately that will have a very negative impact on the competitiveness of our market. So I would certainly urge you to give strong support. I know from when we worked together at the Commission, you're a strong supporter in getting this done right. So I thank you for what all you and Chairman Shapiro and the rest of the commissioners are doing. But I do agree with Stanley. I think this can be negotiated and can be done, and we can't waver, and we need to turn around and get it. It's not easy. It has to be very strategically and thoughtfully planned out. You just can't go waving your, you know, as they say in the UK, we can't just drive our tank on the grass. But on the other hand, there is no question it has been done, and it can be done again.
Let me say I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I'm very glad we don't need tanks because I don't know how to drive one.
The on the issue of convergence on IFRS has taken us more to a race at the bottom than it has to a race to the top. I think in part of that is
due to the concerns that the Council for Institutional Investors have appropriately laid out with respect to the lack of independence. And Joe has noted here that there's a lack of independence in this issue in quality standard setters. I don't think the issue is about convergence at all. I think the issue is how do we get to a high set of standards wherever they're being done. And if, as it's occurred in the international area, that starts to water down and take us in a race to the bottom, we should not be supporting convergence because ultimately it will have, a very negative impact on our markets. And I've watched as the IFRs have been debated, and I've watched the transcripts of those meetings, and time again, we see members of the ISB sitting around the table, especially from the smaller countries, and saying, well, we can't write that standard because we're in a smaller country and we can't get you that information. And it's impacting those standards, and it's having a negative impact on those standards, and that's not what we should be providing to a market to be very competitive. So in this case, I don't think the issue is about U.S. standards. I don't think it's about international standards. I think it's more about how do we get standards that ensure we get high-quality audits wherever we get. And quite frankly, we've had some shortfalls in the U.S. in that area. We certainly had some shortfalls internationally in this area. When people say they're following this international standards, I think as someone, Tony, mentioned, we don't have IFRS. This notion that we hear people going around saying we got international standards in most of the countries, that's baloney. Today, in Europe, within the European Commission, not a single central bank in that country, despite their endorsement of IFRS, not a single central bank in that whole block of countries follows IFRS. They pick what they want to follow, and they pick what they don't want to follow. The French companies aren't following it. We all know that, and we've seen analysts report on this. So this notion of we've got to have IFRS because it is going to give us comparability just isn't true. And as I've heard former Chairman Richard Breeden say in a public meeting at Council for Institutional Investors just over 6 months ago, if all we do is go to IFRS, so everyone's doing the same thing, it will be the darkest day in the history of the SEC, and I strongly believe it. We've got to focus on getting really good accounting standards that give us better transparency and better information to invest on here, and the same thing with auditing standards.
I must say that I agree with you. The point here is to have high-quality standards around the globe, and the point that I initially was trying to make is that we can overcome the inspection problem, but if you're inspecting people who are operating under what are not good standards, and where you're adding on a few things to meet the PCAOB's requirements, you're still going to have a substantive problem. So I do think the two things have to go hand in glove. Because if you solve the inspections problem and you don't have people operating at a high level, you're inspecting people who are not doing a good job. And that doesn't solve the substance problem.
I agree with that, Commissioner, but I will say this. I think some of this is we're like the cat chasing its tail. I think certainly in the foreseeable future, any notion that we'll end up with high-quality auditing standards in countries like China is a figment of someone's imagination. I've just gotten back 6 months ago, spent time with regulators over there. It just isn't going to happen. And until we get by some of the cultural issues in some of these countries, and you mentioned, I think, at least aptly so, there are problems with the laws in some of these countries that do throw up roadblocks, and quite frankly, even during my days at the Commission, we saw where the big four firms went in that particular case, into Italy and got Italy to adopt standards or laws that threw up roadmaps to the SEC. And I will say, in that case, we just told Italy if they wanted to stick with that, they weren't going to come here. But anyway, I think you make some valid points, but I think we also got to recognize that with the cultural differences in part of the world, and not everyone's the same, the notion that we're going to get everyone to sign up to high-quality standards and get to open transparency with good governance and all, it just isn't going to happen. And it's certainly not going to happen in my lifetime.
Pete, why don't we go to you? And I think we're getting beyond a little bit the lunchtime. But I don't. I mean, we shortchanged you the last time, so take as much time as you need, and then Dan can wrap up.
I don't know, being between this group and lunch is worse than being this group in the bar. But for now, we'll try and get all of us to lunch. And I'm just going to add a little bit to what's already been said, actually, on the convergence issue, because back again in my prior life, I was involved in auditing an international company that reported on IFRS. And this was back in the early 90s. At that point in time, in the early 90s, U.S. accounting literature, as Tony would know from serving on the EITF, probably racked and stacked to about, you know, a foot-high stack of literature. International financial accounting standards at that point was about this, you know, this thick. And for those who are on the webcast, you know, the size of a dime novel you could pick up in a bookstore. Now, certainly that's advanced a lot in the last 20 years, but they were playing catch-up from being way behind us. And the same was true on the auditing standard side. So I think, you know, we've talked a lot about tone from the top. I agree with Lynn. It's going to be very hard to get at this, and we're not going to get at it overnight. But I think inspections are just the beginning. I think, you know, for Tom Ray's job on the auditing standard side, I do think we have to put tension and pressure around that to get consistency on, you know, from the top on how audits are viewed and how auditors should be doing their work around the globe, not just here in the U.S.
Oh, I'm sorry, Meredith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I thought the professor's research findings were dynamite. Quite the eye-opener. Speaking as from an investment perspective, the universe we deal in with has thousands of elements in it. We have people pulling the trigger in one way or another each and every day on these thousands of different companies around the world. And even if we're dealing with domestic companies, you know, the portion of their business that occurs offshore, let alone the international portion of the economy, I'm scared to death. We don't have the resources to pick up the phone and call the audit partner, even if he signs it. We can't call up the audit partner and say, gee, and how good is your firm, or the firm in England that has your name on it, or the firm in another company that has. You know, it's nice that a board member can do that, a company board member. But as an investor, we don't have the resources to do that. So we really have to look to the board to really follow, I guess this is my opinion, to kind of take the Judge Sporkin approach. I think we've got to have those inspections, and I would urge the board to make that a high priority to work through that. I know you can't do it overnight, but as the investment community needs that assurance that we have quality firms that have been inspected doing this work around the world for the companies that we invest in, and we don't have the resources to do it.
You know, I'd like to support the endorsement of the work that Joe did and Barbara and Ann with respect to the slides. They will be on the PCOB website underneath the Investor Advisory Group meeting agenda under inspection panel. So thank you very much for that work. Dan?
Steve did ask me to summarize the discussion, although he didn't warn me that two-thirds of the lunch hour would be over with at the time that I was asked to do that. There have been so many valuable points made, I'm not going to try a summary, but I thought I would just note briefly the recommendations to the PCOB that I've heard in this discussion, beginning with the ones that were on Joe's slides. And first, that we, as he puts it, redouble our efforts through negotiations with our foreign counterparts to resolve these issues so that we can conduct all of our foreign inspections. We certainly are doing that, and Rhonda Schneer is our Director of International Affairs and works with her staff essentially full-time on dealing with our non-U.S. counterparts, and I hope we're going to be able to resolve those issues. Second, there were a series of recommendations related to our increasing the disclosure that we provide with respect to the firms of countries that we can't inspect, and that we extend that to the clients, the public companies whose engagements we can't inspect, and possibly to the portions of the work of U.S. registrants, U.S. multinationals. Those are things we have talked about internally. I take those recommendations very seriously, and I think you're likely to see progress on those. Third, there were a series of recommendations related to increasing the requirements applicable to the U.S. firm that relies on the work of a foreign uninspected auditor, or that's part of the same network, that's an affiliate of firms that aren't inspected. We do have a project, as Steve alluded to earlier, we have a project looking at the responsibilities of the principal auditor. I think that's an area where we can strengthen the standards and make some progress in this regard. In addition, I think we have to look at other steps to increase the responsibilities of the signing auditor when we're not able to look at all of the work that's been performed. Some of those are listed on Joe's slides. There have also been suggestions, I think Damon in particular made some, that the SEC look at increased disclosure with respect to the issuers, the public companies, where we can't inspect. I'll leave to the SEC how and whether they might implement that. I would just add that maybe a corollary would be to ask CorpFin in its review process of foreign filings to perhaps take a little bit different perspective in its dialogue with the issuer, where we're not able to inspect the audit of the financial statements. I think that's likely to focus the mind perhaps even more than the 18-point stamp on the cover of the 20F. There was also Ann Yerger's suggestion that we have a lot of information about the nature of foreign oversight bodies, which sort of by default now people are relying on, where we can inspect, and I think we should give consideration to making some of that available to the public. Finally, however, while I've used the word disclosure with respect to many of these recommendations, I think when you look at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, it didn't envision that disclosure was a substitute for us conducting the inspections. That brings us to Judge Sworkin's reminder that we do have enforcement authority in this area. I think about all I can say is that I'm very mindful of the authority we have and the responsibility we have. Few things keep me up at night, but thinking about this one is one of those. I think it's a decision that we would have to make jointly with the SEC because of their ultimate responsibility with respect to our enforcement proceedings. But I unfortunately think that in at least some of these jurisdictions, negotiations, we're 7 years down the road now of negotiating, isn't going to be the full cure, and we do have to think about exercising that authority. Thank you.
And with that, why don't we break for lunch? We're way behind time, so why don't we reconvene at 1:15 to get back on schedule. Thank you. And there'll be lunch for the members in the adjacent room.